Afoot and light-hearted, I take to the open road. Healthy, free, the world before me, the long brown path before me, leading wherever I choose. Henceforth I ask not good fortune. I myself am good fortune. Henceforth I whimper no more, postpone no more, need nothing. Strong and content, I travel the open road. Walt Whitman.
Random House Audio presents Horatio's Drive, America's First Road Trip, by Dayton Duncan, with a preface by Ken Burns. Read for you by the authors, with Tom Hanks, Philip Bosco, Kevin Conway, Jonathan Davis, and George Plimpton.
The way we enter our history. I love to drive. I love to drive. I can think of only a few pleasures in life that are more satisfying than getting in a car and starting out on a road trip, especially if it's new territory. I love realizing, and it is a constant and sustaining realization, that I am on a road I've never been on before, that what I am seeing unfolding before me is brand new. And it is only a short leap in my mind before I start thinking about who were the first Europeans to see this exact view and what they thought. And then it is an even shorter leap, and I'm trying to imagine what this looked like to Native Americans, a pristine, unspoiled nature, ready to accept silently whatever those contradictory and ambiguous humans would do to it over succeeding ages. In those moments, it seems as if it could be possible to comprehend the entire United States, to know it, this beautiful, fragile land, like one knows a familiar and beloved poem, that if one just kept on the road, kept going down new highways, it would be possible not only to express in words, but to actually experience, to apprehend in scope, as perhaps a single blood cell does the whole body, this country I love so much. Such are the dreams of the road, and while I'm perfectly content to do all of this alone, and have in good times and bad, there's something about sharing the journey that magnifies and intensifies all of those thoughts and vistas. An unforgettable trip along the Skyline Drive in the Blue Ridge Mountains with my usually distracted father when I was 5, and its equally memorable compliment 42 years later with my then 14-year-old youngest daughter comes to mind, as does the slightly sad image of my family, including my desperately sick mother, packed into a huge rented station wagon, groaning under the weight of everything we could not bear to entrust to movers, taking our worries and hopes from Newark, Delaware to Ann Arbor, Michigan, when I was nearly 10. I recall a trip to an utterly exotic Florida, complete with a dramatic tire blowout and exquisite pauses to chase armadillos through the jungle, and an all-nighter with other hippies to an anti-war march in Washington, D.C., when I almost choked to death on a lemon drop on the Ohio Turnpike and won $15 at bingo to the chagrin of the regular patrons at the Volunteer Fire Department of Pikesville, Maryland. I have an almost perfect memory of every route and approach we have taken over the last 13 straight summers as my daughters and I headed to the Telluride Film Festival in the majestic and breathtaking San Juan Mountains of Colorado. I can remember as if it were yesterday a trip we took back from Massachusetts at age 9 when I looked out the window and counted under my breath to 8,000 or something equally ridiculous, and the time after my mother died when we survivors drove to the biological station at Mountain Lake, Virginia, where my brother and I would be parked with relatives, and my father made up on the spot what seemed like dozens of hilarious, nonsensical verses to a blues tune he titled 20 Miles from Athens, Ohio. And then there was a more recent trip through a very long night from Michigan with my father's ashes and memorabilia from his disappointing, truncated life slowing me down, my aloneness mitigated by friends and loved ones who gently urged me onward with perfectly timed cell phone calls. but it is the trips I have taken with my dear friend and colleague Dayton Duncan that have meant the most to me over the years and have brought me the most sustained joy and happy memories that I can summon from the road. I first met Dayton 15 years ago on a road trip I had yet to take. We had been then just casual acquaintances when he shared with me his remarkable first book, Out West, in which he retraced and retold Lewis and Clark's stunning and heroic journey in humorous and unusually moving ways. I loved the book. It was eloquent and generous and spoke to a part in me as yet unarticulated that yearned for more experiences of the road. In the highest compliment I can give, no one loves his country more than Dayton, and it is a love tested along hundreds of thousands of miles of roads in the blood system of America. Reading his book and discovering that we shared many other common interests and enthusiasms propelled us into a friendship I treasure as much as any other, and launched a completely satisfying professional association that has produced over the last dozen years several films and companion books, including The West, Mark Twain, and of course, Lewis and Clark, The Journey of the Core of Discovery. Discovery, indeed. That film and book project took us again and again to nearly every spot along the Lewis and Clark Trail as we strained to see and record what the earlier explorers had experienced. Traveling along steep mountain roads or the dirt tracks of the prairie in our trusty Suburban, our friendship deepened. It was clear that we both loved maps and navigating and doing the driving, and while I cannot speak for Dayton, I know now that he is one of the few people I trust unhesitatingly behind the wheel. We both loved to get up early, to steal a march on some remote location, or shot, or sunset. And sometime, I'm not sure exactly when, during that earlier production, we began to play a game with each other. Mindful of the rather limited cuisine at the local cafes of the dozens of small towns we passed through, one of us, just before lunch or supper, would ask the other, "What are you planning to eat once we get into, say, Geraldine, Montana?" At that point, the town would be just visible off in the distance, maybe 10 miles away. With a straight face, the other would launch into the most elaborate description of the most amazing multi-course gourmet meal this side of Paris, France. At which point, the other would say simply, "So what do you want on your cheeseburger?" Then we would silently drive the rest of the way into Geraldine, or such like town, and have a cheeseburger. As I took more road trips with Dayton for the Lewis and Clark film and other projects, an old Spanish proverb would come to mind that the late great animation genius Chuck Jones had once told me. "It's not the inn at the end of the day," he said, "but the road." Like the country Dayton and I both love, dedicated to a pursuit of happiness, always in the process of becoming, the open road leading us onward was the perfect metaphor for our own personal and collective search. Somewhere out there, we would find out something about our country and ourselves, and like Lewis and Clark, it would always be for us a journey of discovery. And somewhere along that road, in the American West, in the mid-1990s, though Dayton insists he told me years before in 1990, I began to realize that he was trying to interest me in making a film on the story of Horatio Nelson Jackson. It was the little-known story of the first cross-country automobile trip, accomplished with exquisite historical symmetry, he regaled me, exactly 100 years after Meriwether Lewis got his marching orders from Thomas Jefferson to find out what the $15 million he'd spent for the Louisiana Territory had bought. Jackson's trip had been made on a dare, a $50 bet, Dayton said, in a men's club in San Francisco, when in front of Jackson some gentleman had poo-pooed the future of the horseless carriage. Jackson had had almost no automotive experience, Dayton continued, and yet he was going to try to do what many automotive experts had tried and failed miserably to do, to drive all the way to New York City in less than 90 days. The story, he said, had everything. It was about freedom, good old American perseverance, the open road. There was humor and the overcoming of obstacles, and because others joined the quest, it was like a race, too, and it showed the country, all of it, on the cusp of extraordinary change. At first, I have to admit, I wasn't that impressed. I didn't yet see a film in it, and I was distracted by several other projects that were demanding all of my attention. But over the years, Dayton continued to champion doing a film and book on what he now called Horatio's Drive. And he began to dig even more, tracing Jackson's exact route on maps, contacting local historical societies and newspapers in the little western towns along the way, where Jackson's trip had stirred up so much excitement and curiosity, and following the trail in Vermont, where Jackson had lived, turning up some tantalizing newspaper clippings and a treasure trove of nearly 100 snapshots Jackson had taken along the way. He visited the Smithsonian in Washington, where the car is still on display, and found a scrapbook filled with newspaper accounts of the journey. At each step, I was impressed with Dayton's dogged determination, not too dissimilar from Jackson's own marvelous optimism, but still not quite sure he had amassed the critical mass to turn this fascinating story into a film and book. Dayton was adamant, however, and so I finally agreed. I trusted him implicitly, and we started to move forward on the project. Although we would like to believe that our films and their companion books offer a fresh and dramatic perspective on the subjects we take on, they rarely break new scholarly ground, offer up new facts unknown to specialists in the field, or do original research. We are content, under the watchful eyes of our historical advisors, to arrange and rearrange existing materials in an artful and dramatic fashion that we hope a national public television audience and general readers will find compelling. But because of Dayton Duncan and his wife Diane's stubborn perseverance, Horatio's Drive will feature new research and add significantly to future understanding of the trip. Checking obituaries, death certificates, and funeral records for possible descendants, and making literally hundreds of cold calls, Diane was able to track down two granddaughters of Jackson's, who not only generously agreed to share memories of their grandfather with us on film, but produced heretofore unpublished letters and telegrams that Jackson had sent back from most of his stops along the way, detailing nearly every moment of his arduous, hilarious, historic, clearly impressive road trip. The letters helped to fill in huge gaps in the story and to settle discrepancies that had cropped up in conflicting newspaper accounts. But most of all, they made Horatio Nelson Jackson come alive as never before. He was a real person now, and now we had a real film. A little later, Tom Hanks would agree to read, off-camera, Horatio's words for our film, and together with a superb supporting cast reading a chorus of other first-person accounts, we felt at times as if we were actually there with Jackson. Armed with Dayton's script, which forms the backbone of this audiobook, we set out to retrace Horatio's Drive, just as we sought to evoke with live modern cinematography Lewis and Clark's progress on that earlier project. We ended up covering more than 10,000 miles, nearly twice as many miles as Jackson, because we had to search back and forth for those dirt tracks and old trails that resembled the nearly impossible conditions Jackson faced at every bend in the road. During our expeditions, we went up Rocky Mountain trails, forded any number of streams and creeks, drove through orchards and alkali flats, went careering down Red Rock canyons, and bumped along railroad tracks, just like Horatio Nelson Jackson. We chased the massive, terrifying storms that still patrol the prairies, just as we are sure Jackson tried to avoid or outrun them. We stood in awe in front of an old Pony Express way station that Jackson passed a century earlier. And one late afternoon in southwestern Wyoming, we filmed along a dirt track that was, at once, a part of the Oregon, California, Pony Express, and Mormon trails. Not far from that spot, we, like Jackson, got lost. We didn't go without food for 36 hours, as Jackson did. But after eating too big a meal at Cruel Jack's, a truck stop near Rock Springs, a few of us might have wanted to. Once, coming into Chicago, where three major interstates converge, we saw more cars in an hour's time than the number of cars that existed in America in 1903, the year Horatio made his impulsive trip. We outfitted our wonderful cinematographer, Alan Moore, with a canvas harness and strapped him to the hood of our Chevy Suburban so that the filming would not just have the painterly style of our previous work, but the visceral, sometimes gut-wrenching perspective that Horatio and his companions surely had. Later, we would distress this footage to give it just the right look we wanted, to give viewers a sense of what it must have been like on the road back then. In the Cascade Mountains of Northern California, two Indians watched in amazement as we charged a mountain stream. Alan mounted on the front, just a few feet from a perfectly good bridge. Near Farson, Wyoming, a ranch hand watched Alan put his bra-like harness on for a drive near the historic South Pass, and then turned to his cowboy friend and said, "I'll be getting free drinks at the bar for a month for telling this story." Along the route, we stopped at country museums, modest libraries, and proud historical societies in many of the small towns Jackson had passed through, and found even more great photos, some of Horatio we never knew existed, and some of town life at the turn of the 20th century that helped us immeasurably in conjuring up that earlier era and the excitement townspeople obviously felt at his arrival. Newspaper morgues in those same small towns added many colorful local accounts that we hadn't known about. Through it all, we could not help but drink up the powerful tonic, the powerful medicine, which moving across this extraordinary country always is. It sustained and inspired and overwhelmed us. We felt often as if we were moving through time as well as through the landscape, and came to understand, as no armchair surveyor ever can, the immense size and almost stupefying distance that is the American West, both today and yesterday, when Horatio Nelson Jackson made his bold and now to us almost unbelievable run. In an interview for our film on Mark Twain, the novelist Russell Banks said that despite our common threads of history with Europe, we Americans have had to write our own epics, our own Iliads and Odysseys that illuminate the differences between us and our European forebears. And the elements, he said, that make us different are essentially two, race and space. As filmmakers who have been interested in learning ever more about the mechanics of our complicated and often dysfunctional republic, we have returned again and again to the question of race in many of our films, trying to come to terms with the monumental hypocrisy born at our inception when our founders attempted to reconcile chattel slavery in a new nation that had just proclaimed the universal rights of all men. But we have also been equally drawn over the years to the power and magnetism of the American landscape, this huge space of ours, and its central role in the formation of a distinct American sensibility and character. It too has figured in some way in nearly every film we have made. Sometimes, as in the West, Lewis and Clark and Mark Twain, Banks's twin themes intertwine and commingle in almost equal and obvious measure. In other films, these themes are somewhat distinct, though the fact that race may have been dominant in the Civil War, baseball, and jazz did not mean that the question of space wasn't always close by, continually influencing the American narrative we sought to explore. In Horatio's Drive, we have tried to paint a seemingly simpler story, one of history from the bottom up, not top down, but one that gets its energy from the sheer physicality of these United States and the extraordinary human beings who have inhabited that space. The virtues and qualities and strengths that we hope radiate out from this story are seemingly simpler too, though as Dayton Duncan knows in his gut, the medicinal force of a great road trip, like the horseless carriage or this still wild American landscape itself, cannot be dismissed. Maybe William Least Heat Moon, author of The Magnificent Blue Highways and a commentator in this film, put it best. There is nothing that we can do that is more American than getting in a car and striking out across country. I think as a nation we can think of few things that draws us more strongly than a piece of roadway heading we know not where. This is the way we grow up. This is the way we enter our history. Get in a car and find the country. And ourselves. Ken Burns, Walpole, New Hampshire. Chapter 1. A Passing Mechanical Fancy. On the evening of May 19, 1903, in the University Club in San Francisco, a group of well-to-do men were sharing drinks and conversation. The talk centered on President Theodore Roosevelt's political fortunes, recent flooding along the Mississippi River, and the chances that the Boston Pilgrims might take the pennant in the brand new American League. Then the discussion turned to another topic, the future of a new machine that only recently had been showing up on the streets of major American cities, the automobile. Horatio Nelson Jackson, a guest at the club and one of the participants in the ensuing debate, suddenly found himself completely outnumbered.
The majority opinion was that, save for short distances, the automobile was an unreliable novelty, a passing mechanical fancy, which thinking men could do no other than discard. The horse, they said, continued to demonstrate his proper place as the dependable servant of mankind for travel.
Jackson was a 31-year-old doctor from Burlington, Vermont. 3 years earlier, after a mild case of tuberculosis, he had given up his medical practice, but he was still energetic and brimming with new ideas. He had just been to Mexico and Alaska to pursue investments in gold and silver mines, and on the way back home, he had stopped off in California to purchase 2 automobiles and learn how to drive them before shipping them to Vermont by rail. I had been something of a horse fancier, owning a small stable of thoroughbreds, Jackson remembered, but I had succumbed completely to a primary enthusiasm for the newfangled horseless buggy. That evening, at the University Club, Jackson argued that the automobile was more than a rich man's toy, suitable only for short drives on city boulevards, and he disagreed when the other men declared that a car could never make it all the way across the country. Everyone, he said, pooh-poohed the idea of even attempting such a journey. Someone wagered $50 that no one could drive to New York City in less than 3 months. Jackson immediately accepted the challenge. Only 4 days later, he would set off from San Francisco, intending to win the bet and make history along the way. At the time, the odds were heavily stacked against Jackson reaching his destination. As a means of travel, automobiles were still in their infancy in 1903. Only 10 years earlier, 2 bicycle mechanics in Springfield, Massachusetts, Charles E. and J. Frank Duryea, had started making what they called gasoline-powered motor wagons, the first American automobiles. Germany's Carl Benz is generally credited with creating the world's first automobile in 1886. Other entrepreneurs quickly followed suit. A young machinist and self-taught engineer in Detroit named Henry Ford produced a quadricycle, a machine that weighed only 500 pounds and could reach the unheard-of speed of 20 miles per hour. In Lansing, Michigan, Ransom Olds made a motor carriage that was better than a horse, he said, because it never kicks or bites, never tires on long runs, never sweats in hot weather, and eats only while on the road. In those early years, electric-powered vehicles were as common as the petrocars that use gasoline or the steamers produced by the Stanley Brothers of Massachusetts, which required 20 minutes in order for their boilers to heat up enough water to get things moving. On some vehicles, the steering wheel was on the left. on others, the right. Left-hand drive would become standard in American cars around 1908. Many had no steering wheel at all, using a tiller or levers to guide the horseless carriage down the street. Some had metal poles mounted underneath that could be dropped like anchors, nailing the car to the road if it started to slide sideways or roll backwards down a hill. Drivers were called motorists, chauffeurs, and as the European term automobile slowly took root, automobilists. Automobiles were beyond most people's financial reach, ranging in price from $650 to more than $6,000, while the average American earned less than $500 a year. Car ownership was limited to the small number of wealthy buyers, doctors, businessmen, millionaires, who could afford the purchase price, and who also often hired a factory representative to arrive with their new car for a week or more of personal lessons in the bewilderingly new intricacies of handling an automobile. For many Americans, automobiles were not only too expensive, they were downright dangerous. In cities all around the nation, residents began complaining about the noise of the new machines, the clouds of dust they raised while whirling through town, and the threat they posed to horse-drawn carriages, bicyclists, and pedestrians. The nation's first fatality from a car accident occurred on September 13, 1899, when Henry H. Bliss stepped off a streetcar at 74th Street and Central Park West in Manhattan, and was run over by an electric-powered taxicab. Vermont enacted a law based on an English statute stating that every auto had to be preceded down the street by an adult waving a red flag. Tennessee required motorists to post a week's notice before starting out on any trip. In Glencoe, Illinois, someone stretched a steel cable across the road to stop what they called the devil wagons. Some cities banned automobiles altogether. By the end of the 19th century, there were only 8,000 cars in the United States, compared to 14 million horses. Blacksmiths outnumbered doctors, and most Americans rarely traveled farther than 12 miles from their home, the distance a horse and wagon could take them from home and back in a day. If they wished to go any greater distance, they had to go by rail, restricting themselves to the railroad's schedule and the confinement of its passenger cars. But to a small number of Americans, the automobile offered new possibilities for the two things they cherish most, mobility and freedom. To them, the automobile represented the future, destined someday to make both the horse and the railroad obsolete. It wasn't long before a few of them decided to dramatize their point by trying to drive all the way across the country. In the summer of 1899, a mechanic named John D. Davis and his wife, journalist Louise Hitchcock Davis, motored their 7-horsepower Duryea out of New York City on the first known attempt to drive a car across the continent, a highly publicized event underwritten by 2 newspapers and an automobile company anxious to prove that American cars were superior to French and English machines. They expected to reach San Francisco in a month. Almost immediately, everything went wrong. Parts broke, a rear wheel collapsed, and the Davis's progress was so slow and torturous that a one-armed bicyclist who had left New York 10 days after their departure passed them before they reached Syracuse. 3 months later, after hobbling into Chicago, the couple gave up their journey altogether. "The automobile," a discouraged Louise Davis wrote, "is a treacherous animal for a long trip." 2 years after the Davis's failure, Alexander Winton made the next transcontinental attempt. Winton was one of the nation's leading car manufacturers. The 100 vehicles his company produced in 1899 had also made it the nation's largest. A renowned innovator in design and production, and a holder of several speed and endurance records, he had earlier won national fame by driving from Cleveland to New York. For this trip, he decided to drive from west to east in order to conquer the hardest part of the journey first, when his car would be at its best. If success in this endeavor is possible, the Motor Vehicle Review promised, Mr. Winton will surely achieve it. Accompanied by his full-time publicity agent, Charles B. Shanks, Winton left San Francisco to great fanfare on May 20, 1901, planning to reach New York City in 2 months. With Winton himself attending to the necessary repairs whenever the car broke down, they made good time surmounting the Sierra Nevadas and were soon crossing the deserts of Nevada. But on the 10th day of the trip, a mere 530 miles from their starting point in San Francisco, the car became stuck in a sand drift, and Winton called an abrupt end to his journey. This automobile has taken more abuse and hard service than any machine ever stood, he bragged of the car his company had made. But with all her power, it is utterly impossible to drive through this sand. A Winton motor carriage cannot be expected to work a miracle. Horatio Nelson Jackson, the next person to try in 1903, seemed even less likely to succeed. He lacked any corporate backing or publicity, knew next to nothing about the mechanics of automobiles, and had done little or no planning. But in his quest to do what no one else had ever accomplished, Jackson possessed two important qualities that would prove invaluable: an indomitable spirit fired by his newfound enthusiasm for the horseless carriage, and deep pockets, thanks to his wife's inherited fortune. Jackson himself came from relatively modest means. A minister's son, born in 1872, he had earned his medical degree at the University of Vermont in 1893 and practiced for a few years in the towns of Brattleboro and Burlington. Then, in 1899, he married Bertha Richardson Wells, the daughter of one of the richest men in Vermont, the founder of Payne's Celery Compound, a popular cure-all that was 20% grain alcohol. It was her money that allowed the newlyweds to make an extended tour of Europe, buy Providence Island in Lake Champlain for a summer residence, invest in mining opportunities, purchase racehorses, and then automobiles, all despite Jackson's having given up his medical practice. And it would be her money financing his improbable journey across the nation. Bertha, whom Jackson affectionately called Swipes, for reasons forever lost to history, supported his decision to make the trip, but thought it best to return home by passenger train instead of accompanying her husband. In her place, Jackson hired Sewell K. Crocker, a 22-year-old former professional bicycle racer from Tacoma, Washington, who was working in California as a mechanic in a gasoline engine factory. Crocker may also have been giving Jackson and his wife private driving lessons on the two automobiles they had recently purchased and already shipped back to Vermont. For the arduous trip they were now about to attempt, Crocker strongly advised buying one of the touring cars produced by Alexander Winton's company in Cleveland, the sturdiest and most reliable automobile being made, in his estimation. "It will carry you through if anything will," he told Jackson. But no new ones could be found on the Pacific coast. The Winton Motor Carriage Company would make a grand total of 850 cars in 1903, part of the roughly 11,000 autos manufactured in the United States that year, bringing the nation's total car registration to 33,000. Most new cars, especially top-of-the-line vehicles like the Winton, were pre-ordered from the manufacturer rather than purchased at a dealership. After a quick but persistent search, Jackson at last found a Wells Fargo executive in San Francisco willing to part with a 1903 Winton, but only for a $500 bonus over the list price of $2,500, even though the car already had nearly 1,000 miles on it and both rear tires were already in poor condition. Jackson gladly paid the $3,000 and immediately went to work with Crocker on preparing the car for the journey. The Winton had a 2-cylinder, 20-horsepower engine directly underneath the driver's seat, with a chain drive capable of speeds up to 30 miles per hour, 2 speeds forward and 1 reverse, steering wheel on the right, no windshield, and no top. It featured 2 of Alexander Winton's many engineering innovations, a ratcheted lever that prevented broken arms if the machine unexpectedly backfired in the midst of being crank-started, and a hinge that allowed the steering wheel to be tipped away as the driver took his position. Leather upholstered seats were mounted high on a wooden body painted a reddish maroon with, as the sales brochure promised, just enough polished brass to enliven the general effect. Crocker removed the back seat to make room for the piles of equipment Jackson quickly purchased, sleeping bags and cooking gear, rubber Macintoshes for themselves, and even one that covered the entire car, coats and sweaters, and 2 telescope valises for their clothing, a set of tools, including 2 jacks, a spade, and a fireman's axe, a block and tackle with 150 feet of hemp rope, fishing gear, a shotgun, rifle, pistols, and ammunition, and a small Kodak camera to record his trip. With Jackson, 225 pounds, and Crocker, 150 pounds on board, the fully loaded vehicle weighed more than 1.5 tons. There were no gas stations at the time. The first would appear in St. Louis in 1905, but general stores in most towns carried fuel for farm machinery, stoves, and water pumps. The Winton's gas tank held between 11 and 12 gallons, sufficient to run the car about 175 miles over ordinary roads, according to the company's sales brochure. Jackson strapped on additional tanks to carry 5 gallons of cylinder oil and 12 extra gallons of gasoline in case of an emergency. Unable to locate new tires for the worn pair on the rear wheels, he hoped the single spare he brought along would suffice if one of them gave out. According to the Winton Company's numbering system, the car Jackson had purchased was number 1684, but its new owner concluded that a machine entrusted with so much needed a name, not a number. Like many automobile owners who would follow him, Jackson already was thinking of his new car as if it had a personality of its own, despite the injunction printed clearly in the Winton's instruction manual. Remember, it said, that an automobile has no brains. You must do its thinking. It is merely a man-made machine, subject to man's control, and under thoughtful handling, will perform all the work for which it is designed. In honor of the state where he and Bertha made their home, the place he hoped Winton number 1684 would eventually deliver him in triumph, Jackson officially christened his vehicle the Vermont. With that, a mere 4 days after making his impulsive wager, he was ready to go. Chapter 2. The hardest work I ever did.
My darling Swipes, the hardest work I ever did was to say goodbye to you. I came pretty nearly having cold feet. There isn't one woman in 1,000 that would let a fellow do what I have done, and I can tell you, old girl, I appreciate it. Please give my best love to your mother, and tell my father and mother that I love them as much as ever. I shall write you when I can, and shall depend on you to keep them posted. Yours till New York, Nelson. P.S. Take good care of yourself, and don't worry.
After seeing his wife off at San Francisco's railroad station on Saturday morning, May 23rd, 1903, Jackson joined Crocker in the early afternoon at the Palace Hotel, and the two of them set off in the Vermont for their long journey east. They crossed the bay on the Oakland Ferry and made good time through the town of Hayward. But only 15 miles into their trip, a rear tire blew. Crocker replaced it with the only spare they had, and they motored on to Tracy for the night, having covered 83 miles for the day, according to the car's cyclometer. The next day, after passing through Stockton, they bought 5 gallons of gasoline in the town of Galt from a storekeeper who seemed bemused to see tourists in a horseless carriage.
The old man said when he got rich, he was going to buy one of these GD machines so that he could spend his money fast. He would break down his neighbor's fences with it, he said, that he wouldn't have any money left for his children to fight over.
They stopped in Sacramento to make minor repairs to the Vermont, fixing the spark igniter, buying some second-hand tire tubes since no new ones were available, and attaching an acetylene headlamp to the front of the car for night driving, because they already realized that the Winton's side lanterns were, Jackson said, useless to illuminate the road. During his stay in Sacramento, a delegation of local bicyclists, then a doctor, then a banker, all offered Jackson advice on the roads ahead and gave him some rudimentary maps to pore over. He needed all the help he could get. A forbidding prospect lay before him. At the time, of the 2.3 million miles of road in the United States, fewer than 150 miles were paved, all of them within city limits. A mere 6% of the remaining road miles were considered improved, treated with gravel, and virtually all of those were in the east. The rest were mostly dirt paths, suitable at best for horses, cows, and slow-moving wagons. Roads were not only bad, for the most part they were also unmarked, since the only people who usually traveled them were local residents who didn't need signs to tell them which turn to take. By 1903, a few companies had begun publishing guidebooks with detailed instructions on how to get from one town to the next, compilations of lists such as Start at Civil War Monument, Go West 1.3 miles to Granite Watering Trough, Turn Left for 0.6 miles, Bear Right under Railroad Overpass, Go 0.4 miles to White House, etc., etc., that might go on for 2 pages simply to cover a 20-mile trip. But these books, cumbersome as they might be, were available only for heavily populated portions of the East. In the West, where the roads were much worse and the distances much vaster, no one had yet bothered to publish guidebooks. To cross the continent, Jackson decided it would be best to follow the routes of railroads as much as possible, to use their rights of way as a road if necessary, even use their trestles in places where no other bridge could be found. And to avoid the sandy wastes of Nevada, which had defeated Alexander Winton 2 years earlier, he determined to detour north through Oregon, even though it would add more than 1,000 miles to his journey, and for a while, take him through places where even railroads did not exist. Despite all the obstacles in his path, Jackson optimistically planned on averaging up to 200 miles a day across the continent.
We leave in the morning for Oroville, the last railway point we will have until we strike Ontario, Oregon. When we get there, the worst will be over. I can run the car as well as Crocker, and have rather surprised him. We take 2 hours on and 2 off at the wheel. He is a mighty good man. I am fine, and the only trouble is, I miss you so. Nelson.
On May 25th, they started for Oroville, traveling through miles and miles of fruit orchards on dusty roads Jackson described as a compound of ruts, bumps, and thank you marms. We never noticed, he added, as our cooking utensils jolted off one by one. When we discovered our loss, we could not afford to turn back to seek them. Then they discovered something else. They were lost. Their fortunes seemed to brighten, Jackson later remembered, when they came upon a red-haired young woman riding a white horse.
"Which way to Marysville?" I asked her. "Right down that road," she said and pointed. We took that road for miles, and then it came to a dead end at an isolated farmhouse. The family all turned out to stare at us and told us we'd have to go back. We went back and met the red-haired young woman again. "Why did you send us way down there?" I asked her. "I wanted Pa and Ma and my husband to see you," she said. "They've never seen an automobile."
Long after nightfall, they finally pulled into Oroville by the light of their new searchlight. "Everything is all okay," a tired Jackson wrote his wife. "I shall take my car through to New York," he promised, underlining the words for emphasis before signing the letter, "Yours till death." He awoke the next morning, planning to reach the town of Alturas, 158 miles to the northeast, before nightfall. But shortly after setting off, he learned that snows on the mountain passes blocked the direct route he had hoped to take through the northern Sierra Nevadas. So they detoured northwest through the valley towns of Chico, Nord, Vina, Tehama, and Red Bluff, over steadily deteriorating roads, with the brief exception of a few miles near Vina, where the late railroad magnate Leland Stanford had invested in improvements near one of his estates. "Ahead of us, like a guidepost, towered Mount Shasta," Jackson wrote. But with each mile, it was leading them away from, not closer to, their ultimate destination. After covering 114 miles, they chugged into the tiny hamlet of Anderson, where they put the Vermont in a livery stable and checked into the town's only hotel, hoping for a good night's sleep to prepare for crossing the lower mountain passes of the Cascades. But bedbugs drove them out of their room, and they spent the remainder of the night trying to sleep in their car. Early on the morning of May 27th, the ascent into the mountains began. They climbed steep, rocky trails no automobile had ever traveled, mostly low gear work, Jackson wrote, that required frequent stops for Crocker to fix the clutch. The spark igniter faltered again, and they stopped to get it working correctly. Yet more stops occurred when sharp stones pierced the car's tires. They patched the inner tubes and reinflated them by hand pump, then pushed on.
Often the trail narrowed to 10 feet, one-way thoroughfares established by nature. Sometimes it was necessary to remove boulder blockades by hand. Slipping on shale and loose rocks, weaving around mountain ledges, we staked our careers against none too reliable brakes on steep descents. Around hairpin turns where, jolting and skidding, we suddenly looked down sheer precipices.
The winding trail was crisscrossed by mountain streams, usually with no bridges over them. Jackson and Crocker had no choice but to put the Vermont into high gear and try to get across at top speed. "We welcomed some of the creeks," Jackson said, "to let the car's hot tires cool." But one creek was too deep, and the Vermont got stuck in midstream. The men took off their shoes and pants, waded to the other shore with the block and tackle, attached it to a tree, pulled the car out with the rope, and then continued on the bumpy road. We were lucky not to have lost our block and tackle, for bit by bit our equipment was disappearing, including my own spectacles and fountain pen, Jackson wrote. They passed through Bella Vista and Round Mountain, were forced to pay a $4 toll to use a privately owned stretch of bad, rocky mountain road, and after covering 69 miles in 12 hard hours, finally made it to Montgomery for the night. Their troubles worsened the next day. Jackson wrote, "Took 5 gallons of gasoline and left Montgomery at 8:45, hoping to get to Fall River for lunch, but got off the wrong road and lost 20 miles. Found bridge down and lost 14 more. Tire blew up twice and repaired it with rope. Are now running on rope. At Bernie, we had our clutch fixed and gave him 2 bits. Reached Fall River at 4:30. Took 10 gallons of gasoline, still climbing, snow all around us. Roads very narrow and rocky. On the road, we ran out of cylinder oil and we had a storage tank in the inside of the boot with a tap running down through the bottom of the carriage. The tap got stuck, so Crocker crawled under the carriage with a wrench. He was lying on his back. He started the tap but couldn't stop it and got 2 gallons of oil in the chest and face. He is now wearing my clothes, and the others are on the side of the road." During it all, Jackson somehow lost yet another pair of spectacles while the Vermont bounced along. But he couldn't help admiring the scenery, dramatic vistas of mountain peaks and the ancient volcanic cone of Lassen Peak at one turn. At another, a vertiginous view down a narrow canyon to a beautiful waterfall on the Pitt River, 1,000 feet below their trail. "A grand sight," he wrote to Bertha. "I never went through such country in my life." Mount Shasta now faded completely from sight behind them as they wound through dense stands of ponderosa pines and finally came down out of the Cascades and headed for Alturas in the northeastern corner of California, 700 miles by Jackson's calculations from their starting point. The one-day trip he had so blithely planned from Oroville had turned into 4 days of breakdowns, repairs, and delays. He wrote his wife, "Alturas, nowhere, 3 miles back of sundown, Saturday morning."
"My darling girl, we have crossed the mountains and don't expect to come to any more until we get into Idaho. We have proven that my machine can do or go anywhere. I feel confident we can make it. How I wish you were with me, and that it was possible for you to take the trip. With a barrel full of love, I am, as always, yours, Nelson."
Chapter 3, One of the Wonders of the Century.
Quite a flurry of excitement was erected Friday evening by the arrival of an automobile. Very few of our citizens had ever seen this, one of the wonders of the century. And large crowds gazed with curious interest at the horseless wagon. The Indians especially never tired of gazing at the machine. Indeed, had a flying machine lit down in their midst, it would not have created greater astonishment. Alturas Plain Dealer.
In the town of Alturas, Jackson decided to wait for a day. On his way through the mountains, he had telegraphed back to San Francisco for a new set of badly needed tires, some new batteries, and a new cyclometer to help him measure distances. And he had been promised by Wells Fargo that a stagecoach with his shipment would soon catch up with him. One day passed, then a second, and a third. Still no tires. On Monday, June 1st, Jackson wrote his wife.
"Well, old girl, I am rather provoked over our delay. I've lost 5.5 days. This is a bad start. But just as soon as I can get decent tires, we will make a record run. Crocker is more interested than ever and is keeping the machine up in good shape. I feel more confident that I can make New York. We are causing a great sensation. It is the first machine that has ever gone over these mountains. Yesterday, the farmers drove in for miles to see my machine, and there has been 100 people around the livery stable since our arrival. I've been offered all prices to take them for a ride. I have promised some of the cowpunchers a ride if they will get me up a good roundup. They're planning for it this afternoon, and I expect to see a regular Wild West show."
Reveling in the avalanche of attention he and his machine were attracting, the Alturas' new era had proclaimed, "Quite a sight for Alturasites, a real live auto steams into town." Jackson nonetheless had become frustrated by the long wait for new tires. More than half his time on the road so far had been consumed by such delays. "I don't believe we would appreciate our trip if we didn't have these accidents, etc.," Jackson wrote his wife. "But if it hadn't been for our tires, we would have been in Ontario today." Obviously concerned that Bertha might be getting equally impatient for him to make better progress, Jackson assured her, "I know that you know what this trip will mean to me if I can carry it through, and that I will. So you will be brave and patient until I come. I know it is hard, but it is also for me. I miss you so. I shall rush it through." By Tuesday, June 2nd, when the shipments still had not arrived, Jackson decided to leave Alturas anyway, in no very good humor, according to the local paper. Still, a large crowd gathered to see him and Crocker off with many handshakes. The plane dealer expressed their sentiment, "We join with all of our citizens in wishing the doctor and his companion a godspeed and a happy termination of his journey." With its rear tires wrapped in rawhide and rope, the Vermont pulled out of Alturas. Despite the tires' condition, Jackson expected to make good time now that he was out of the mountains, and he had set his sights for the day on Burns, Oregon, 220 miles to the northeast. But only a few miles into the morning, a front spring broke, and the Vermont limped along at under 10 miles per hour. Even at that pace, Jackson's sun cap, coat, and another fountain pen somehow jostled loose and fell by the wayside. 6 hours later, they reached Lakeview, Oregon, where it seemed as if the whole town was waiting for them. The crowd had been building since early morning after being alerted by telegram that the Wonder, as the Lakeview Herald called it, was on its way, and since the Vermont would be the first automobile ever to reach Lake County, this was enough to put every man, woman, and child in Lakeview on the keen edge of expectancy. The competing paper, the Lake County Examiner, was even more breathless.
The way the streets of Lakeview were lined with people Tuesday afternoon, one would think a circus was coming to town, or a 4th of July procession was about to pass. While it was neither, the people's curiosity had been aroused from a report that an automobile was coming this way, and that if they wished to see it pass, it was necessary to have a seat in the front row, otherwise it might go through at the rate of 90 miles an hour, and would be out of sight before they could run a block. It hove in sight at just 4 o'clock, and the crowd surged forward to get a first look at a real live auto, a machine that 9/10 of the people of Lake County had never seen. The machine drove up in front of the Hotel Lakeview and stopped. The chauffeur inquired for a blacksmith shop, having had a mishap coming over the rough roads.
A local blacksmith was put to work fixing the front spring, never sensing, Jackson said, that our strange vehicle was a symbol of doom to his profession. And a local merchant charged him $3 a gallon for gasoline, nearly 10 times the average price in most cities. The next day, Jackson wanted to get moving again, even though the repairs weren't completed until mid-afternoon. Jackson wrote home, "Just as we were ready and had left the blacksmith shop, the inner tube gave way, and we ran to the outskirts of the village to repair it. We went over what inner tubes we had and found that they were rotten. We put 3 patches on the best one and succeeded in getting air into it at about 5 o'clock, and away we started. But old cat fate was against us, for we only ran 3 miles. Then she blew again." They had no choice now but to return to Lakeview and wait for the stagecoach to reach them with the supplies they had ordered from San Francisco.
Thursday. Loafed all day and kept the telegraph wire busy to keep in touch with the tires. We spent most of the day in Mr. Lake's bicycle shop, and Crocker made $3 repairing a Colombian bicycle. Some of the people here have never seen a railroad or been away from the place for more than 50 miles. A little boy asked his teacher if he could have a holiday to see the auto.
Late on the night of June 5th, the stagecoach with the tires, batteries, and cyclometer finally arrived. And by early the next morning, Jackson and Crocker had everything ready. Ahead of them lay nearly 300 miles of Oregon desert, a barely inhabited area that had the added distinction of being farther from a railroad than any other place in the United States. Jackson hoped to cross it in 2 days and reach Ontario, where he had telegraphed ahead for more tires and supplies to be waiting for him at the train station. At 6 a.m., they set off from Lakeview for their dash across the desert, but almost immediately got confused and went 19 miles down the wrong road before realizing it. By 8 o'clock, thick dust was already clogging one of the Vermont's two carburetors, and they had to stop to clean it. Then, the car wouldn't start. The new batteries were defective. Time after time, they struggled to get a sufficient spark, but with no luck. Hours ticked by. Crocker tried everything he could think of to coax the Vermont to life, but still it refused. Noontime came and went. Then, most of the afternoon. About 4 o'clock, they spotted a cowpuncher in the distance, and Jackson called him to them by firing his gun. A few minutes later, the 20-horsepower automobile that people had called one of the wonders of the century found itself lassoed and being dragged like a stubborn calf across the desert floor by a cowboy and his horse. The cowboy towed them to the nearest ranch house, where Crocker again went to work and at last got the Vermont running. They set off immediately, following what Jackson called the damnedest rough, rocky, sandy road this side of Hades. The route also took them along the shore of Abert Lake, whose alkali-impregnated waters put off a pungent smell. Fortunately for us, Jackson wrote his wife, our olfactory centers are not very sensitive. 14 long hours after leaving Lakeview, they reached a ranch called the SL.
The ranchman kindly offered to give us his attic for the night, so we crawled up the ladder for bed. Here we found a pile of rags in one corner with two blankets that every settler coming that way since 49 had slept under. It is needless to say that we each sat on a nail keg and waited for our host and hostess to get to sleep. This we soon discovered from the sonorous sound that came up through the planks of our floor, whereupon we both jumped out of the window and had a very comfortable night in one of the horse stalls in the barn.
Somehow, word of their troubles filtered back to the Lake County Examiner. If they meet with as many accidents and are delayed as long as they were in Alturas and Lakeview, the newspaper reported, it will be winter before they see the Atlantic. On the morning of June 7th, Jackson and Crocker resumed their journey across the desert and soon encountered homesteaders traveling by wagon to some of the only free land still available in the nation.
I cannot see why they come to this desert, but the Oregon agents seem to be able to paint them a most beautiful picture of the homesteads here. One poor fellow, seeing us coming down the road, thought the train had got off the track, so he hastily unharnessed his horses, and he and his wife crawled under the wagon. Of course, when we came along, we frightened their horses, and they ran many miles across the desert. I was very sorry for the poor fellow, but he was as green as they make them.
They passed the dry bed of Alkali Lake and the almost invisible hamlet of Wagon Tire, where the roads became so rough, Jackson and Crocker decided instead to make their way through the endless sagebrush, which soon stripped off their new cyclometer, making it impossible to measure distances. And somewhere along the way, the gasoline in their storage tank leaked out. When they reached an outpost called Okerman's on Silver Creek that evening, they had less than a quart left. It was 26 miles to Burns, the nearest town where gas might be available. With no telephone at Okerman's, Jackson rented the owner's bicycle and sent Crocker off on it. He was gone all night and half the next day, forced to walk most of the distance when his bicycle tire was punctured, and finally returned with 4 gallons of gasoline and 3 gallons of benzene, which, Jackson complained, cost him nearly $20. But the supply of fuel got them to Burns, where a local doctor gave them 5 gallons of gasoline, and then to Harney, where they purchased 15 gallons more. Farther east, a ranch wife fed them a good meal, but didn't have any extra beds or even a stable to offer them, so they slept on the ground next to the Vermont. A fitful night, Jackson reported, constantly interrupted by a sow and her noisy piglets. They began their fourth day in the desert with more than 100 miles yet to go, but the car kept grinding to a halt every time the undercarriage got hung up on the high crown in the center of the rutted road, sometimes requiring the men to use jacks to set it free. They bought lunch at a ranch that Jackson called the dirtiest place I ever saw, and then, in the afternoon, the front spring broke yet again, delaying them once more. The only comfort was a hot spring they encountered, where, Jackson wrote, we had a mighty good, necessary wash. Pressing on in the evening, they discovered to their dismay that they had run out of cylinder oil. This time, it was Jackson's turn to walk for help. It was very dark indeed, and I did not like at all the idea of trying to find someone, not knowing where they lived or how far I'll have to go to find them. After walking about an hour, there was an awful commotion in front of me which made my hair stand on ends and my legs run about 100 yards as fast as they could go. It was nothing but a poor cow that I had disturbed on its night slumbers. I haven't got over it yet. By whistling, I managed to raise a dog, and by following the sound of its bark, found an old ranchman, and when I told him where we were, he said if we had gone over the first hill for about 0.5 mile, we would have got into Vail. I got back about 3:30. Then we proceeded to Vail, making that night and day 112 miles. In Vail, they finally found some cylinder oil, and late on the afternoon of June 10th, their 19th day on the road, they motored the last 17 miles to Ontario, Oregon, a town near the Idaho border, and more important, a stop on the Oregon Short Line Railroad. Waiting for them at the station were a full set of new tires and a new front spring. When we saw the railroad, Jackson told his wife, we both felt like throwing up our hats and giving 3 cheers. Chapter 4, An Enthusiast for Motoring.
Thursday, June 11th. My dear Swipes, we put on our new springs and one new tire and left Ontario a little after 4. We crossed the Snake River by a ferry and are now in Idaho. Shortly after we left, it commenced to rain, and for the first time we had to take out our rubber clothing. This made traveling very bad. We found a stream to ford and thought, of course, we could make it as we had many others, by shooting it. But the mud was very deep, and we got stuck in the center of it. So for the second time, we had to use our block and tackle. The rain was coming down in buckets, and we had to work a good deal up to our knees in mud and did not arrive in Caldwell until 12 o'clock at night, and then soaking wet. We put up at the Pacific Hotel, and the people noticed we were carrying with us a very strong odor. We had run over a skunk.
As early in the trip as Sacramento, and for reasons unexplained, Jackson had been looking for a small dog to accompany him on his attempt to cross the continent. In Idaho, he finally got his chance, thanks to the kind of misadventure that had now become almost routine. They had pulled out of Caldwell early on the morning of June 12th, but after driving a few miles, Jackson realized he had left his coat at the hotel. On our way back, he wrote Bertha, we were stopped by a man and asked if I didn't want a dog for a mascot. As I had been trying to steal one, we were glad to get him, so accepted the present, consideration $15. So Bud is now with us. Bud was a young, light-colored bulldog, and whatever the rationale for adding this third member to the expedition, he almost immediately began attracting as much attention as the Vermont. Crossing the continent a century earlier, Meriwether Lewis had brought along a Newfoundland dog named Seaman, for which he paid $20, and it too created considerable stir among the natives they encountered. Some newspapers would report that Jackson had rescued Bud from a savage dogfight. Others wrote that he was a lonesome stray who had chased after the car for 2 miles before being taken on board. Bud soon became an enthusiast for motoring, Jackson bragged, especially after his masters put a pair of their goggles on him to keep the stinging alkali dust out of his eyes. Riding in front, Bud learned to watch the road ahead as intently as Crocker and Jackson, bracing himself for every bump and turn, and becoming, his owner said, the one member of our trio who used no profanity on the entire trip. The day of Bud's arrival ended as it had begun. Even though he was now taking roads that paralleled the railroad tracks and planned on making up for lost time, Jackson got bad advice in Nampa and followed the wrong set of tracks, which took them 38 miles out of their way before they realized it and had to backtrack. At the end of 15 hours on the road, they reached the town of Orchard at 11 p.m., a mere 45 miles from their starting point. The three of them spent their first night together, sleeping under the car. When they arrived in Mountain Home the next day, the local newspaper reported that the Vermont, being the first horseless carriage in the village, created quite a sensation and attracted crowds of curious people who surrounded it as flies surround a keg of sorghum. The rains that greeted them to Idaho had not let up, and hearing reports that the main road to Pocatello would be difficult, Jackson impulsively detoured northeast again, this time toward the town of Haley, at the edge of the Sawtooth Mountains, thinking conditions might improve. They didn't. The roads, he wrote, were extremely bad and wet, and many times we had great difficulty in pulling the car out of the mud. We got stuck good and fast about 7 in the evening, and after working 2 hours with our block and tackle, we finally had to give it up. We made a little tent out of our Macintoshes and crawled into our sleeping bags for the night. Adding to their misery, Bud had become sick after drinking some alkali water. In his letter to Bertha, Jackson spared her the details on the symptoms. The next morning, one of them hiked half a mile to a sheepherder's cabin and persuaded him to bring his horses to pull them out. For the rest of the trip, in honor of the combined effort of the Vermont's engine and the team of horses, Jackson would refer to the place as the 24-horsepower stream. And as he had several times already on the trip, Jackson paid for the services and a home-cooked meal by providing his host with a short ride on what some locals were now calling the go-like-hell machine. In Haley, Jackson telegraphed the Winton Company in Cleveland, placing an order for them to ship him a new air intake pipe, since the original had dropped off somewhere along the road. It was the first time he had contacted the company directly, and the first time Winton officials became aware that one of their cars was trying to cross the continent. Their detour next took them through what is now Craters of the Moon National Monument, a desolate, eerie landscape shaped and reshaped by a series of volcanic cataclysms. The country took on a new character, Jackson wrote, soaring heights of denuded slopes, monstrous cliffs, and giant boulders scattered in magnificent confusion. 60 years before Jackson, wagon trains of pioneers had ventured this way on what was called the Goodales Cutoff on the Oregon Trail. 60 years after Jackson, astronauts would be brought there to train for the first lunar landing. Traveling south now, along the edges of the vast Snake River lava beds, they reached the towns of Blackfoot and Pocatello, then took what Jackson called an exceptionally good road that followed the rail line and allowed them to open the Vermont's throttle as they whirled into the quiet village of Soda Springs, where the local paper, the Idenhaw Chieftain, announced his arrival under the headline, "It Startled the Natives."
The first automobile to invade Soda Springs rounded the corner at Whitman's store just at sundown Tuesday night, and with a toot that sounded like a young foghorn, whizzed up Dillon Street and stopped at the Idenhaw Hotel. When the cowboys, sheepherders, and Indians recovered from their surprise, they caught their breath and let out a whoop that was taken up and passed along the entire length of the block. The interest in roulette and 21 was temporarily suspended until the strange machine had been thoroughly examined and the curiosity of the crowd appeased.
In Soda Springs, Jackson discovered that yet another personal item had fallen off the bouncing car. This time, it was another coat with most of his remaining cash. He telegraphed Bertha to wire him $200 in care of the Western Union office in Cheyenne, Wyoming, a city more than 350 miles to the east, which Jackson, despite all his experiences on the trip to the contrary, felt confident he could reach in a few days. On June 17th, they rattled off toward Wyoming and quickly made 30 miles until the hub and bearings on a front wheel gave out. In Montpelier, Idaho, they borrowed some bearings from a farmer's mowing machine and had a local blacksmith install them with a cone he crafted out of iron. The delay cost them the rest of the day, but Jackson's optimism was undiminished. On Wednesday, he wrote his wife from the Hotel Burgoyne in Montpelier, Idaho.
"Darling Swipes, just a line to say that everything is all right with your wandering boy. I can't write much as we sleep, then work. When you hear that we have reached Rawlins, Wyoming, you will know that I can make the trip a go, so bet all the money you have got on it. Well, old girlie, I can't say any more. You know how I feel. I shall make up for lost time."
Soon after crossing into Wyoming the next day, the blacksmith's iron cone fell apart. They inched their way to Diamondville, site of a large coal mine, where a machinist offered to help Crocker make a new cone out of tempered steel. They slept that night in the machine shop, made the repairs the next morning, and after giving all hands a ride, Jackson wrote, got a late afternoon start for the town of Opal. "Just as it was getting dark, we got stuck in a deep mud hole, and I walked 13 miles to get someone to pull us out. I got back about 3 o'clock, and we worked from that time until 9 in the morning, drying up our wet batteries." Things got even worse on June 20th. A tremendous cloudburst struck the area after they passed through the town of Granger, flooding and washing out the road they were following. They resorted to trying to navigate across the Badlands, cutting bundles of the ubiquitous sagebrush to place under the spinning tires in muddy spots, getting out the block and tackle when the car got stuck, changing direction every time they encountered a gully too deep to cross, and getting hopelessly lost. "We zigzagged as best we could," Jackson wrote. "Sometimes we went north instead of east. At others, we even went northwest, bringing us back where we had been before. They struggled along for hours, ultimately going, by Jackson's estimates, 69 miles out of their way.
Coming to the bank of a river, we judged from our maps and compass that it was the Green River, and we resolved to follow its downward course. When night came on, we made camp beside the car, and having lost our cooking outfit and provisions, and being in an uninhabited region, went to bed without any supper.
Their roadless meanderings had brought them to a place that had challenged countless other overlanders in American history. Not far to the east was the famous Parting of the Ways, where pioneers who had just crossed the Continental Divide at South Pass faced the first of many agonizing choices between which trail to take. Cutoffs promising a more direct route, but a potentially fatal lack of water, versus a longer trail whose oxbow curves kept closer to streams and rivers, but might mean slower progress and the chance of being caught in mountains farther west when winter set in. 49ers on their way to California had passed this way. So had the Mormons. So had the doomed Donner Party. Jackson and Crocker had now been on the road for 29 days. Of them all, this day had already proved to be the most disconcerting and potentially discouraging. The violent storm, the washed-out roads, and the confusing maze of gullies that had finally deposited them, wet and hungry, on the banks of a river too big to cross. But as they went to sleep that night, they were luckily unaware of something that would only have added to their worries. Back in San Francisco, two other men had departed on their own car trip across the continent.
San Francisco, June 20th, 1903. At 2 o'clock, Tom Fetch mounted and took his place at the steering wheel. Beside him, I took my seat. And now, without further formalities, the course was steered to the famous Cliff House in San Francisco, overlooking the Pacific Ocean and the Seal Rocks. Thence to depart with a few whiffs of salt breeze to cheer our memory on the long landbound expedition. Marius Crarup.
Tom Fetch and Marius Crarup had been chosen by the Packard Motor Company to drive one of its brand new 12-horsepower touring cars from San Francisco to New York. Fetch was a test driver for the company. Crarup was a reporter for Automobile Magazine, going along to file regular reports on what Packard's advertising chief admitted was a spectacle to attract public attention and prove the car's durability. For 3 months, well before Jackson had ever made his rash bet, the Packard company had been planning their trip. It was everything that Jackson's expedition was not. The Packard had been modified to carry more gasoline and have better gearing for steep mountain grades. Each day's itinerary along the main route of the Transcontinental Railroad had been predetermined, with extra supplies already placed at strategic points, and the men's personal luggage shipped ahead by train each morning to the next stopping place. To help with any mechanical problems, an expert machinist from the Packard factory in Warren, Ohio, was even sent along, riding in the cars some days, taking the train ahead on others. Pulling out of San Francisco on June 20th, Fetch and Crarup made excellent time right from the start. By the fifth day, they had crossed the summits of the Sierra Nevada at Lake Tahoe and descended into Carson City, Nevada. Learning from Alexander Winton's disaster with deep sand 2 years earlier, they came equipped with two long strips of heavy canvas to roll out across soft spots and provide enough traction to keep from bogging down. On their first day on the Nevada desert, they covered more than 70 miles and felt confident enough about their progress to take the next day off in Wadsworth, simply to wait for more film for Crarup's camera. When they left, they carried with them a case of 12 bottles of beer, packed in ice. Crarup wrote,
In the immediate vicinity of the town rises a sandhill of formidable proportions. Such is the tradition of its terrors that the town cheerfully expected us to return for reinforcements. And when we arrived at the top, we found an enterprising man awaiting developments with a team, rope and tackle in readiness for our expected emergency, as well as a crowd of interested spectators. Broad-minded enough to see that the laugh was on them, they cheered us loudly as we passed.
As they cruised across the desert in a direct line toward New York, everyone they met was impressed with their meticulous preparation and astonished at their progress. And everywhere they went, Fetch and Crarup steadfastly ignored the fact that Jackson was already on the road. A mere 10 days out from San Francisco, they were already halfway across Nevada. Chapter 5. The worst of it is over. Jackson awoke along the banks of the Green River on the morning of June 21st, still lost in western Wyoming, after suffering through a night he described as the time that 30,000 mosquitoes died on the back of my neck. But his more immediate concern was food. It had been nearly 36 hours since he and Crocker had last eaten, and both of them, he joked later, were stealing speculative glances at Bud as we tightened our belts. They followed the river south, hoping it would lead them to a town or a homestead. Instead, they finally came upon a lonely sheep herder who said he hadn't seen another human being in 3 weeks and happily offered them a feast of roast lamb and boiled corn. The finest meal, Jackson said, I ever ate. When the sheep herder refused to be paid for the food, Jackson insisted that he at least accept a rifle as a token of appreciation. If he had asked us then for my car, Jackson added, I believe we would have given it to him. With full bellies and the directions the sheep herder provided them, Jackson and Crocker were soon heading east once more, along the route that would one day become the famed Lincoln Highway, and half a century after that, Interstate 80, the principal thoroughfare across the nation. It paralleled the Transcontinental Railroad line and took them through the towns of Bryan, Green River, and Rock Springs. A circus arrived by rail in Rock Springs the same day, Jackson wrote his wife, and we are taken for part of the show.
Monday, June 22nd. They are charging me 60 cents a gallon for gasoline. And as there is no pay station between here and Cheyenne, I am unable to get any money. We are spending most of the time trying to get out of water and mud holes. We buried our car completely in one, and after working half a day to get it out again, three Italians came along, each packing a heavy bag. I explained to them that the next stop was 12 miles away, and that if they would help us out, I would take their baggage in for them. This they consented to do, and in about an hour we were on our way again. After delivering their luggage to the section boss, we started on for Bitter Creek, crossing two rivers over the railroad bridge. We had no trouble in crossing railroad bridges. With practice, bumping over bridge ties is no great task. Sometimes, though, we had to hunt for 5 miles to find a place where we could get our machine on the track.
At a train stop called Bitter Creek, Jackson found himself entirely out of cash and pawned his watch for $10 from the station agent. From the depot, he telegraphed Bertha a brief but descriptive message. Rain, washout, bum roads and luck, broken spring, crawl to Rollins. They pressed on, encountering deep sand holds that required them to get out the block and tackle and hook it to an anchor they drove into more solid ground, there being no trees anywhere in sight. Then they would attach the rope to the car's rear axle, whose spinning would slowly winch them out once the engine was started. In other places, they had to dig themselves out by hand. I have done nothing but use my hands in place of my 20-horsepower engine to propel my car from Granger to here, Jackson wrote Bertha, and the only thing that I can handle now with safety is my knife and fork. On June 23rd, exactly 1 month after leaving San Francisco, they pulled into the town of Rawlins and made arrangements to stay at the Ferris Hotel, looking forward to their first comfortable bed in nearly a week. But as Jackson and Crocker drove the short distance to park their car in a livery stable down the street, the Vermont came to a noisy and sudden stop. The stud bolts holding the connecting rod to the crankshaft sheared off, and it pierced through the crankcase cover, the worst mechanical breakdown to date. This was a problem that could not be fixed without new parts from the Winton factory in Ohio. Jackson had no choice but to telegraph the company and wait for a train to deliver them. We could not possibly have much worse luck than we have during the past 3 days, and we have had enough to discourage any army, Jackson wrote his wife, but I will bring my car through to New York if it takes a leg. Driving into Rawlins, Jackson and Crocker became inadvertently drawn into a minor drama being played out in small towns all across America at the dawn of the auto era. The gamesmanship for bragging rights over who would be the town's first car owner. In Rawlins, the participants were Dr. John Osborne and Henry Murchison. Osborne, an ex-governor and one of the town's most prominent citizens, had let it be known in late 1901 that the distinction would be his as soon as his, quote, champion favorite arrived from the East. But then a fire at the factory disrupted production, and word circulated that Osborne's delivery had been postponed. Sensing an opportunity, Murchison quietly placed a rush order for an 8-passenger steam-powered machine called the Red Devil from a San Francisco company. Rawlins's first automobile arrived by train on April 5, 1902. It was Murchison's, but it had been shipped in parts, and apparently without all the instructions for assembly. With local assistance, and no doubt a lot of joking advice from a gallery of onlookers, he finally managed to put the car together. But despite his every effort, he could not get it started. The Red Devil was still sitting in the street, immobile, when a freight train unloaded Osborne's champion favorite on April 23rd. Fully assembled, it was motoring around the streets of Rawlins within hours, Osborne sitting proudly at the wheel. Weeks passed, then months. As Osborne went to and from his office, made his house calls, took small pleasure jaunts in his new car, all the while basking in the town's attention and envy, Murchison could only watch from the seat of an auto that would not move. The embarrassment eventually became so acute that he quietly pushed his vehicle into a storage shed and out of sight. Then Jackson and Crocker drove into town, and for the first time in nearly a year and a half, hope stirred in Henry Murchison's heart. He brought Crocker to the shed where the listless Red Devil had been housed, explained his dilemma, and begged for help. The next edition of the Rawlins Republican told the result. Under the headline, Murchison's Mobile is All Right, the newspaper announced that, quote, yesterday, Henry Murchison was seen driving around the city in his horseless carriage, which he has been unable to use on account of not being able to generate power to keep it going. The brief story duly credited Crocker for the machine's transformation, and then hinted that Murchison's competitive fire had also been rekindled. He is considering a trip to New York, the paper said, and if he does, he will overtake Dr. Jackson before he gets halfway. For his part, Jackson spent the 5 days they were stuck in Rawlins arranging for his bank to send him more money, writing long letters to Bertha, waiting impatiently for the parts to arrive, and learning for the first time that Fetch and Crarup were on their way from San Francisco in their Packard.
Ferris Hotel, Rawlins, Wyoming, June 28, 1903. My darling Swipes, just a line to say that I am still alive. Our things arrived this morning, and we held divine services in the blacksmith shop. We shall try and get away tonight. Our car will now be as good as new. We have had hard luck, but I think it all came at once. We shall now try and make a record trip. The worst of it is over, and everyone is congratulating us. There are others on the way, trying to beat us across, but I feel confident they will give it up.
With their car repaired, Jackson and Crocker headed for Laramie, and at Elk Mountain encountered some of the steepest slopes of their journey, rocky trails in which they sometimes had to jack up the car to get out of deep ruts or stop to push boulders out of their path. In other places, ranchers were using the road as irrigation ditches, slowing the travelers down even more on the slippery surface. 17 times in one day, the men resorted to the block and tackle to keep moving. "I never worked so hard in my life," Jackson told his wife, "but we can show what the machine and good men can do." Along the way, an old Wyoming rancher asked Jackson where they had come from. "San Francisco," he was told. "Where were they headed?" the man asked. "New York," they replied. "Where is your home?" he finally inquired. And when Jackson answered Vermont, the old man exclaimed, "What in hell will you Vermonters do next?" In Medicine Bow, an enterprising storekeeper learned just how badly they needed gasoline and made the most of it. Jackson was so outraged at the gouging that when he arrived in Laramie the next day, he complained about it to the local newspaper, The Boomerang.
Dr. Jackson said that when he left Oregon, the sheriff there warned him to beware of holdups, but that the only place he believed he had been held up so far was at a place he believed they called Medicine Bow, crossing between here and Rawlins, where they charged him $5.25 for 5 gallons of gasoline.
East of Laramie, they struck the best road they had traveled since California's Sacramento Valley, and they sped along on it to Cheyenne, where a large crowd gathered to gawk at what the Wyoming Tribune called a whiz wagon. The Tribune also noted that Bud's eyes are badly bloodshot from the exposure to alkali dust. It is to be doubted that he is enjoying the journey, the newspaper opined, as he spends most of his time resting under the car. From the Inter-Ocean Hotel in Cheyenne, Wyoming, Jackson wrote his wife.
July 1st, 1903, darling Swipes. I have just shook hands and talked to 200 people, and the only way I could get away was to say that I had a little wife at home that was expecting a letter from me. You don't know how glad I was to get your 3 dear letters. They put new vigor into me, you dear girl. Well, the worst of our trip is over, and everyone now says that we can make it, and although there are others on the way, we will get there first. Just watch me now. Nellie.
Behind lay the ramparts of the western mountains, the alkali deserts, and the sagebrush-choked broken terrain that had bedeviled and delayed them since late May. Ahead stretched the Great Plains and the farm country of the Midwest, gently undulating land that invitingly offered the prospect of 1,000 miles of relatively straight, flat roads all the way to Chicago. "We will make up for lost time," Jackson promised his wife, "and you will see by my telegrams what time we are making." But the first telegram he sent after leaving Cheyenne on the afternoon of July 2nd told a different story. Flywheel came off shaft, held here for several days. Less than an hour out of Cheyenne, the stud bolts on the other connecting rod had broken off, and the Vermont had ground to a dead stop. "Our feelings," Jackson wrote, "may be more easily imagined than described." A railroad grading crew towed the car to their camp near the small station of Archer. Crocker stripped the front seat off the car to get at the engine, while Jackson wired the Winton factory once more for replacement parts, and once more settled in to wait for their delivery by train, day after agonizing day.
Sunday, July 5th, 1903. My darling Swipes, We expected our express on number 5 at 3 this afternoon, but a message this noon from the train agent says that he has nothing, so it is another day. It has been an awful long time to us, and I shall be mighty glad when we are on the way again. And unless another serious accident happens, we ought to be able to make good time across these plains. Well, tomorrow is our anniversary, and I wish I could be with you. I want to celebrate here by getting my new parts. I shall think of you a good deal tomorrow, as I always do. You are the best little wife in the world, and I'm a mighty lucky fellow to have you. Yes, old girl, I appreciate it, if sometimes I have a queer way of showing it. 4 years tomorrow. They have been very short and dear ones to me. You have done everything in the world to make me happy. I shall just tear up the ground until I can be with you. With lots of love to all, I am yours. P.S. I am not much of a hand to write love letters. You didn't give me a chance for much practice, but you know, dear, how I feel.
Separated from his wife by roughly 2,000 miles, on July 6th, Jackson marked their 4th anniversary with a brief telegram. Many happy returns of the day and much love. Parts did not come today. But apparently, he had also made arrangements via telegraph for Bertha to receive a gift in his absence, because a few days later, he dispatched a cryptic and otherwise completely incomprehensible message. That is a pretty blue dress you have on this afternoon. Jackson had now been on the road for 42 days, nearly half of the 90 specified in his wager. But he was only a third of the way to New York, and his car now seemed to be breaking down at every turn. Even worse, with Tom Fetch and Marius Crarup and their Packard following a more direct route across the West, Jackson was concerned that they might be catching up with him. They were. Except for the day spent waiting for more film, Fetch and Crarup had been constantly on the move. The factory mechanic traveling with them had kept the car operating efficiently, and they were running right on schedule. On July 3rd, they completed their second week of travel by covering 114 miles and reaching Promontory, Utah, where the Golden Spike joining the first transcontinental railroad had been driven in 1869. And on July 4th, after driving another 106 miles, they pulled into Salt Lake City to a wave of publicity, precisely what the company's advertising executive had planned. So far, they have had no accidents and have not been towed afoot, gushed the Salt Lake Tribune. Their chief difficulty, in fact, has been the malice of rural guides who several times have sent them off on the wrong roads. At the rate they were going, despite starting nearly a month later, Fetch and Crarup were now only 10 days behind Jackson and Crocker. Complicating matters even more, on July 6th, yet another automobile set off from San Francisco for New York. Lester Whitman and Eugene Hammond were driving a 1903 Oldsmobile runabout, the first automobile to be made on an assembly line, and the first that would outsell electric and steam-powered machines. It was smaller and cheaper than the two big touring cars that were already on the road. But like the Packard Expedition, this one was also underwritten by the manufacturer. Ransom Olds himself had provided Whitman and Hammond, both experienced drivers and Oldsmobile mechanics, with the car, free tires, and the promise to reimburse their expenses and pay them a $1,000 bonus if they reached New York successfully. Hoping to generate extra publicity for their trip, Whitman and Hammond picked up a letter from San Francisco's mayor and promised to carry it east and deliver it to the mayor of New York. Following the same route as Fetch and Crarup, they quickly crossed the Sierras and were well into Nevada within a week's time. There were now 3 automobiles racing to become the first to cross the continent. Chapter 6. Buffalo Wallows. On July 7, 1903, Jackson sent his wife a message at the Western Union Telegraph Office in Archer, Wyoming.
July 7th. Darling Swipes. Parts arrived. Leave this noon. Now in good shape. Hope to be with you soon.
On July 7th, with another five-day delay waiting for parts and repairs behind them, Jackson and Crocker were eagerly on their way again. Following an old military and stage route from Cheyenne to Julesburg, Colorado, they crossed the rolling grasslands into Nebraska, stopping briefly while a blacksmith repaired the front axle, which had broken along the way. At the Platte River, they once more began tracing the same route blazed by pioneer wagon trains heading for Oregon and California half a century earlier. Nominally, the roads were improving as they moved eastward, but the summer of 1903 was turning into one of the wettest summers in memory. A second flood, Jackson wrote Bertha. Rain, 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 and plenty of mud. And the roads had become quagmires.
When we crossed into Nebraska, the mud became worse instead of better. Here it rained constantly. The mud was a cement-like mass that stuck to things like the best Portland, and it seemed to have no bottom. The car sank in it clear up to the battery boxes, that is, nearly to the tops of the wheels, and then we would get out the block and tackle and haul it out. One day we repeated this performance 18 times. These places were locally termed buffalo wallows. We wallowed in them, sometimes tearing down a section of fence and put them under the wheels to make a foundation.
On their most frustrating day, they worked from 6 a.m. to midnight to make a mere 16 miles. Covered with mud, Jackson stopped at a small homestead, hoping to buy food. "Perhaps I did look trampish when I knocked at the housewife's door," he later recalled, "but no sooner did I mention food than the door was slammed in my face with the admonition, 'We don't give no handouts here.'" They detoured north for a while, away from the Platte River, and ran along the edges of the Nebraska sand hills, picking up speed as they finally found better roads. They rushed through Kearney and Grand Island and dozens of smaller farm towns, and as the telegraph lines announced their impending arrival in each one, people flocked to see Jackson and his machine. Not because an automobile was a novelty in this part of the country, but because of growing curiosity about whether Jackson was about to make history. Disappointment was keen, one newspaper reported, when he tore through the towns at a 40-mile-an-hour clip without stopping. The Columbus, Nebraska Telegram told of an encounter that was even more disappointing.
"The collision of an automobile with a horse and carriage was a novel scene enacted on one of the main traveled roads west of Columbus last Saturday afternoon. Fred Lamp was in the carriage, and a pair of strangers were driving the automobile. The road in that vicinity runs parallel with the Union Pacific Railroad. Mr. Lamp was driving a fractious horse, and for several minutes he had given the most of his attention to an approaching train behind him. He failed to see the automobile coming from the other direction until it was close upon him. Then he turned quickly to the right, as custom has established in passing teams on the public road. But the automobile turned in the same direction, and the two vehicles came together. For a few minutes, horsehair, cuss words, and escaping steam were flying through the air, and it was pretty hard to tell what kind of damage was going on. Then the air cleared. Neither the occupants nor the vehicles were damaged seriously. Mr. Lamp and his horse drove away with a proud, defiant air, and after a while, the automobilists made their getaway in a cloud of steam. The identity of the chauffeurs is still unknown. It is believed they were a wealthy San Francisco doctor and his friend who were touring the continent in their horseless carriage."
In a final, long, nonstop effort in Nebraska, they covered an astonishing 265 miles, even though the front axle once more snapped in two. They borrowed a short piece of iron pipe from a farmer, hastily shoved the broken axle ends into it, wedged them in place with tire irons, drove another 20 miles until they found a blacksmith who welded things back together, and kept on moving through the night. "Two bottles of Payne's Celery Compound pulled me through," Jackson joked in a telegram to Bertha to explain his endurance. On the morning of July 12th, they rolled into Omaha, near the place where Lewis and Clark had held their first meeting with American Indians nearly a century earlier. Now, a huge crowd turned out to greet Jackson and his expedition. From the Paxson Hotel, Jackson wrote his wife, "Sunday night, you naughty girl. I have lost 6 hours of valuable time reading your dear letters when I ought to and want to work on my car so that I can be with you as soon as possible. But I can tell you, I was damned glad to get them. You dear girl, it did me a lot of good and made me a little homesick. On our arrival here this morning, we found half of the city turned out. I never thought a little thing like what we have done could get up so much interest, but I have received today bushels of telegrams from all over congratulating me, and the whole city has had a piece of each of my old shoes. Good night, old girl. Watch me now. More reporters downstairs. Yours till a widow, Nell." By this point, Jackson had grown adept at giving interviews to newspaper reporters, and some of his adventures, occasionally exaggerated or slightly modified for local consumption, already were coalescing into an entertaining and spellbinding narrative he delivered at each stop. The improbable bet in San Francisco, the homesteaders cowering under their wagon at the Vermont's approach, the addition of Bud on his way to becoming as much a celebrity as Jackson himself, the kindly sheepherder's meal after 36 foodless hours, the struggles with buffalo wallows, a term the reporters seemed to love as much as Jackson, and the holdup at Medicine Bow, a story he told so well that no reporter could seemingly resist repeating it. President Theodore Roosevelt, one of Jackson's personal heroes who shared some of the same traits of limitless enthusiasm, can-do optimism, and chronic impulsiveness, had passed through Omaha in his special train earlier in the summer on a frenetic and wildly successful whistle-stop tour of the western states. As leader of the nation and a master of press relations, Roosevelt had commanded much bigger crowds and larger headlines. But Jackson, who had by now also become accustomed to welcoming parties and a clutch of journalists scribbling down his pronouncements, could not resist comparing himself in some ways to the youthful president he so much admired. "Me and Prez Roosevelt has had quite a reception through the West," he exulted to Bertha in one letter. 2 days later, apparently still pleased with the thought, he told her the same thing again. The Omaha Morning World Herald emphasized Jackson's expenses as well as his adventures.
"Dr. Jackson is not in the automobile business, nor in the advertising business, but is making the trip across the country for his own pleasure, and to prove to a party of friends that the trip can be made. In fact, it has proven quite an expensive luxury, for the repair bills have been enormous, to say nothing of the other expenses. The experiences and adventures of the trip have been of an exciting nature, which may be better understood when it is known that he traveled 3,000 miles through a country never before touched by an automobile. Before leaving, the machine will have a thorough overhauling and be put into condition for fast running. Incidentally, half a ton of Nebraska clay, which it has gathered during the past few days, will be removed, and the car will be made more presentable."
The spreading news of Jackson's quest, as well as the heavy publicity surrounding both the Packard and the Oldsmobile journeys, had not only aroused greater public interest in the Vermont's progress, it had spurred the Winton Company into action. A representative from the Cleveland office was waiting for him in Omaha with a surprising proposal. To make sure Jackson arrived in New York first, the Winton Company was willing to provide him with the same financial and logistical support that the Oldsmobile and Packard companies were giving the other two expeditions. For someone beset with so many mechanical delays and now openly complaining to every reporter about his mounting expenses, this must have been a tempting offer, though it would mean the trip would now become as much the Winton Company's as Jackson's. That evening, in his letter to Bertha, Jackson revealed his answer.
On our arrival here, I was much surprised to find a man from the factory with a letter congratulating me and stating that they were willing to place men along the line with supplies at their expense. I have informed them that we have made the trip so far without their assistance, and thought that perhaps we two greenhorns could do the rest of it.
Winton's man, he added proudly in a hasty telegram the next morning as he pulled out of Omaha with Crocker and Bud, cannot understand how we made it. Following the route of the Chicago and Northwestern Railroad and what would later be the Lincoln Highway, now U.S. Highway 30, they sped across Iowa and western Illinois in such a rush that Jackson didn't even pause long enough to send more telegrams to let Bertha mark their progress. The constant rains made the roads very bad, Jackson would later tell a reporter, but after the buffalo wallows, they were child's play. A few inches of mud made little difference to us, and we seldom had to fall back on our faithful block and tackle.
A huge automobile, manned by a couple of sphinx-like men, shot through Jefferson on Tuesday morning, halting long enough on the west side of the square to oil up and replenish the big gasoline tank,
reported the Jefferson Bee in central Iowa.
It was a big, unwieldy machine, built low, had wide rubber tires that could pick up dust by the bucketful, and yet it could run like a greyhound. The men in charge were as begrimed as a couple of colliers, looked as if they had absorbed a sack of dirt externally, with more than a peck on the inside. The motorman was a dabster in his line and could pretty nearly turn his machine round on a half-dollar coin. They pulled out for the east in a cloud of dust and made Grand Junction in a trifle over 30 minutes. They were not arrested for fast driving. Nope. To cook your hair, first catch your hair.
For the first time on the entire trip, Jackson was finally stringing together consecutive days without mishaps, breakdowns, or delays, and he was regularly averaging nearly 150 miles per day, something he had boasted to reporters in California, Oregon, Idaho, and Wyoming that the Vermont was easily capable of, but until now had rarely achieved. The Marshalltown, Iowa Reflector considered Jackson and Crocker both badly bronzed and sunburnt from their days in the open car, but they seemed to be enjoying their trip immensely. Farther east, the Clarence, Iowa Sun noted they had passed through town in the evening, making good time, and presciently predicted that the next few years will see many of these pass through here. They crossed the Mississippi at Clinton, and 4 days after leaving Omaha, pulled into Chicago, where Jackson proclaimed, "We have come to the conclusion that we can run our car over any road that a man can take a team of horses and a wagon, providing we can get traction." We were honored with receptions by city officials, automobile dealers, and hero worshipers generally, Jackson wrote, but the one thought in our minds was to finish. A caravan of automobile enthusiasts gathered to escort them out of Chicago the next day, but the departure had to be delayed. Bud was missing. Bud had taken it into his head to see the city, according to one newspaper account, and his owners and others chased him around for some time before he could be found. Restored at last to his place of honor as the most satisfied passenger, Bud sat in the front seat as the Vermont led the procession of cars to Hammond, Indiana, then continued east on its own, passing through LaPorte on its way to South Bend after darkness fell. Another 150-mile day over rain-soaked roads brought them to Toledo, Ohio on July 19th, where the Toledo Times reported, "The trip has not been a cheap one, as Dr. Jackson said last night, that if anyone figured on making the trip, he would advise them to figure out their expenses and multiply that by 20. Once more, Jackson recounted the familiar tales of his adventure. Once more, Bud in his goggles and his alkali reddened eyes featured heavily in the story. As Jackson neared Cleveland, home of the Winton Motor Carriage Company, the firm's executives sensed an imminent public relations bonanza, even without their direct sponsorship. In fact, they would soon realize that Jackson's independence from the company made his story all the more compelling, and his choice of a Winton that much more valuable as an endorsement for the vehicle. They wired Bertha an urgent telegram asking her to rush special delivery all photographs which Jackson had been sending her from the road, and promised to return them in good order. They stoked the local press into a frenzy. "Bold chauffeur, due today," one headline blazed. Another called Jackson the daring automobilist. Yet another referred to the hazardous trip supposed to be impossible. Bud, the Cleveland Plain dealer, advised its readers, was so ugly that he is handsome. On July 20th, the 59th day of Jackson's journey, the Winton Company's advertising manager, Charles B. Shanks, who had accompanied Alexander Winton on his aborted transcontinental trip in 1901, led a convoy of cars to Elyria, Ohio, 27 miles west of Cleveland, for a well-photographed personal handshake with the Continent Trotters. He then led them triumphantly into the city for a grand reception hosted by the Cleveland Automobile Club. According to the Motor Age magazine,
"The Jackson party left Chicago at noon Saturday and arrived in Cleveland at 5 p.m. Monday. Remarkably good time for notoriously bad roads, which had been rendered worse by continued hard rains. The party went to the Hollanden Hotel for a cleanup and for supper, while the faithful bulldog mascot remained in charge and fought flies and kept off inquisitive newsboys. In the evening, the car was taken to the Winton garage and given a thorough cleaning. Except for its heavy coat of mud and dilapidated front tires, the car is little the worse for its rough usage."
"When we started on this trip, my wife asked me how long it would take," Jackson told one of the many reporters who now hung on his every word. "I told her 6 weeks and possibly 6 months. I also told her that I would make the trip if it took a lifetime. I was positive that it could be done, and I have met with success where Alexander Winton and others failed." Sometime that evening, Bud was apparently released from guard duty long enough to sit, fully goggled, with Jackson and Crocker for a formal portrait for the next morning's paper. Jackson was now confident that this time the worst was really behind him, and he now believed that the other two expeditions could not possibly beat him to New York. It seemed like a safe bet. Despite their fast starts from San Francisco and all their meticulous planning, both expeditions had begun to run into problems of their own. In Salt Lake City, Tom Fetch and Marius Krarup's car had been seized by a local sheriff because of a lawsuit filed against the Packard Company by a disgruntled ex-employee. After 2 days, the company posted a $5,000 bond, and the expedition was underway once more. But instead of continuing along the direct route of the Transcontinental Railroad, Fetch and Krarup turned southeast into the canyons of Utah and the heart of Colorado's Rocky Mountains, a route pre-selected for them by Packard's advertising director back in the East. "Like a dumb fool, I was thinking from the standpoint of publicity, with pictures of mountains and canyons," he said later, "but what I sent them into was something terrific." They damaged an axle going through the difficult Wasatch Mountains, fractured a ball joint going through Castle Valley, got stuck trying to ford the Price River. In Colorado, rain made the roads so greasy they wrapped the tires with steel chains as they slowly wound their way through the Rockies. When they finally reached Denver on July 20th, a procession of cars with horns blaring led them into the city like a drove of cattle, according to the local newspaper, and the townspeople greeted them like heroes. But Fetch and Krarup were now 1,300 miles behind Jackson, and New York City, they estimated, was still 5 weeks away. The Oldsmobile runabout was even farther from its goal. To help them get through the Nevada deserts, Lester Whitman and Eugene Hammond had brought along special sand tires they had made themselves, canvas strips stuffed with cotton rags that kept the back wheels from sinking down in the deep drifts. But the car's chain drive was so severely damaged climbing a hill that they lost several days of progress, first finding a horse and wagon to tow their car to a railroad station, then losing another day when the replacement parts that arrived were the wrong ones, and they had to make temporary repairs at a blacksmith shop. More breakdowns plagued them, a damaged piston, then a broken part that allowed them to drive in reverse, but not forward. On July 20th, while Whitman and Hammond were in the midst of a three-day delay, waiting for more parts to arrive in Elko, Nevada, Jackson was 2,000 miles farther east, excitedly riding his wife from Cleveland in preparation for the final leg of his journey.
Monday evening. Darling Swipes, well, old girl, I have brought the car to its birthplace, and a great reception it got. We had quite a procession into the city. They are all like a lot of kids. The car is at the shop, and they are to work all night so that I can get away in the morning. I go from here to Buffalo. I am tired and got to get up early in the morning, and I am damn anxious to get you in my arms. Watch me now come to you. Nell.
Chapter 7. Watch Me Now. Jackson wrote Bertha again. Darling Swipes, while I think of it, I want you to order two full sets more of the Kodak pictures and have one set sent to Mrs. B.D. Crocker, Tacoma, Washington. Keep the other set for me and bring all pictures and photos to New York when you come to meet me there. That is, if you care to come. I have made arrangements to have the Winton agent at New York to take you up the Hudson to meet me. When I telegraph you to come down, leave on the first train, telephone the agency you are at the Holland, and I will telegraph you both to then come. Watch me now come to you. Nell. Jackson set off from Cleveland with Crocker and Bud on July 21st, intent on reaching New York City as quickly as possible. To avoid the risk of crossing Pennsylvania's Allegheny Mountains, he decided to turn northeast along the Great Lakes to Buffalo, then to Albany on a new state road, before turning south again to follow the Hudson into Manhattan. It would add several hundred miles to the trip, but as Jackson told a reporter, we have had enough of mountains. They quickly covered the 200 miles to Buffalo, despite rain so fierce that Jackson telegraphed the Winton Company, if it continues, we'll ask you to send paddles for the wheels and rudder for the rear of car. May have to take out navigation papers. The Vermont, he told a reporter, was now splattered with samples of mud from every state they had crossed, and he didn't intend to wash any of it off until the trip was finished. Running on roads that paralleled the old Erie Canal, they pushed on across New York State, sometimes driving well into the night, simply to put more miles behind them. He was sure he could make it to New York City in a matter of days, win his bet, and become the first person to drive across the continent, unless the Vermont broke down completely. Then, the unthinkable happened.
East of Buffalo, traveling in high, at least 20 miles an hour, the machine struck a hidden obstruction in the road. Crocker, Bud, and myself were thrown high in the air. Two mud guards were torn off, and the machine otherwise damaged. But fortunately, none of us was hurt.
The Vermont was bruised, but to everyone's relief, still able to run. They drove on through Rochester, then Syracuse and Utica. After a night's rest in Little Falls, with the skies cloudless for the first time in weeks, they decided to take advantage of the break in the weather and drive the final 230 miles without stopping. They rolled through Schenectady, crossed the Hudson at Albany, and turned south on the Albany Post Road along the east bank of the river. News of their approach brought out cheering crowds as they passed through the towns of Hudson and Poughkeepsie. Night fell. On they went. In Peekskill, they delayed to patch a punctured tire by the glow of a hotel's outside light. There, Jackson's wife met him, along with a delegation of reporters and Winton Company officials who hailed Jackson as the automobile pathfinder and bedecked the Vermont with a banner that was inscribed, "First across the continent, San Francisco to New York." Then the small cavalcade motored south for the final miles without incident, except for a brief moment of confusion when it was discovered that a sleepy bud had jumped into the wrong car. He was awakened by a sharp command from his master and restored to his rightful place in the front seat of the Vermont. At 4:30 in the morning, on Sunday, July 26th, they crossed the Harlem River into Manhattan, drove down a quiet Fifth Avenue, nearly deserted because of the early hour, and honked their horn to awaken the night porter at the Holland House Hotel at 30th Street. Jackson had made it from San Francisco in 63 days, 12 hours, and 30 minutes, well within his wager of 90 days. And having become the first to drive a car across the nation, within hours of their entrance into New York, he and Crocker and Bud were the toast of the town. The New York Herald reported,
"Dr. H. Nelson Jackson and Sewell K. Crocker, his chauffeur, finished the first transcontinental automobile trip at 4:30 yesterday morning. On their arrival, the mud-besmirched and travel-stained vehicle, which had borne them so faithfully and sturdily over 5,600 miles of roads, was housed in a garage in West 58th Street. All day yesterday, it was visited by admiring automobilists and curious passers-by peeped in upon it. In honor of its achievement, it was decorated with tiny flags and draped with national standards. A thick coating of mud gave evidence that it had been somewhere, and that somewhere a long way off."
For the next 4 days, a parade of reporters marched in and out of the Jackson suite at the Holland House to interview the automobile pathfinder about his thrilling dash over roadless country, as newspapers all across the nation told and retold Jackson's story, sometimes embellishing details, including one report that claimed the Vermont had floated across rivers, using its revolving wheels as propellers. Jackson was described as a sturdy, blue-eyed giant who had lost 20 pounds from the rigors of his journey. Roosevelt, on the other hand, having been feted with lavish banquets at every stop and constantly pampered en route by a personal chef on his presidential train, had complained about gaining 17 pounds during his cross-country trip. Bud, with and without his goggles, was a news photographer's dream come true, although one newspaper reported that he was not accepting visitors. Crocker was always mentioned in the newspaper accounts, often with Jackson's heartfelt appreciation for being essential to the trip's success, but never quoted directly. One reporter noted that Bertha, a sweet-faced brunette who had approved of and urged the transcontinental attempt, could not resist the temptation to peep occasionally from an adjoining apartment to add a bit of information and comment to the recital of the journey's detail. She had brought along the letters and telegrams her husband had dispatched from the road. Jackson's father, the Reverend Samuel N. Jackson, was also on hand with newspaper clippings his son had sent him. Jackson seems to have thrived on all the attention being lavished upon him, with one exception. A stylishly dressed woman sent her card to his room, saying she represented a New York newspaper. But when Jackson let her in, she promptly served him with a court summons, a complaint from a local dressmaker claiming non-payment of $1,360, perhaps the anniversary present Jackson had ordered via the telegraph from Wyoming. When asked about it by a reporter, for the first time on his trip, Jackson had no comment. He later said it was an unjust claim, and its disposition is unknown. In all, Jackson estimated that he had spent $8,000 of his own money on the trip, the price of the car, a salary for Crocker, food and lodging, the seemingly endless need for new tires and replacement parts, 800 gallons of gasoline and the $15 to purchase Bud. But, he said later, it was worth every cent and every pound to win that $50 bet. In later years, different journalists would report different accounts about collecting his winnings, some quoting Jackson as saying he never got his money, and others saying that he did. His granddaughters, however, vividly recall how he distinguished the issue. He won the bet, he told them, but he never collected the money. Before leaving New York, Jackson wrote a long letter to the Winton Company describing his journey in their automobile. Eager to squeeze the maximum publicity possible out of his trip, the company quickly published the letter with a raft of his photographs in their publication, The Auto Era. They also began running large advertisements in trade publications, calling their touring car's achievement without parallel in American automotive history, and ironically, making the most of the fact that before starting the trip, Jackson consulted neither manufacturer or sales agent. His vehicle, quote, was not a specially constructed car. The men who occupied the seats were not selected factory mechanics who had spent weeks and months in preparation, and there was no elaborate system of relays for duplicate parts, new tires, and general supplies. When rumors later surfaced that perhaps Jackson had actually driven two vehicles, or that he shipped his car across part of the West via railroad, some suspected the Packard Company as the rumor's source, the Winton Company immediately publicized a $10,000 reward to anyone who could produce the slightest evidence showing the truth in any of the various malicious stories. Angered that his own honor had been challenged, Jackson personally added $15,000 to the company's pot. No one ever came forward. And in the end, based largely on the local newspaper clippings Jackson had collected in one small town after another, and on the letters and telegrams Bertha had saved, the major automotive press soon declared that Jackson's journey was authentically the first automobile trip across the nation. On Thursday, July 30th, Jackson and his wife, with Bud on board, headed home together in the Vermont. The trip took a week and was punctuated by the problems and delays he had become accustomed to by now. The low-speed clutch broke in Hudson, then the high-speed clutch gave out in Albany, and a breaker box failed in Middlebury, Vermont. Near Shelburne, Jackson's two brothers showed up in their own automobile to escort him and Bertha the final 10 miles. But a cylinder blew out in their car, so Jackson chained it to the Vermont and towed them the rest of the way into Burlington. At last, on the late afternoon of August 7th, he reached his home on the corner of Willard and Main Streets and went to park his trusted car in the stable. Just as the Vermont crossed the threshold, its drive chain, one of the few parts that had made the entire journey without a problem, snapped in two. 2 weeks later, Tom Fetch and Marius Crarup and their Packard finally made it to New York City, having completed their trip in a day and a half less than Jackson's time, but finishing second nonetheless. They were escorted into the city by a host of Packards and greeted by a cheering crowd. "Thank the Lord," one of them said as he got out of the car. "It's over." On September 17th, Lester Whitman and Eugene Hammond reached New York in their small Oldsmobile runabout. Total time, 72 days, 21 hours, and 30 minutes. In a festive ceremony at City Hall, they finally delivered the grease and water-stained letter they had carried all the way from San Francisco's mayor. And in a gimmick, to gain greater publicity for their company, Whitman and Hammond then drove up the coast to Boston, where they dipped the Oldsmobile's front wheels into the Atlantic and claimed to be the first true sea-to-sea drivers. Meanwhile, back home in Vermont, Jackson soon had his car up and running again, as a clipping from a local newspaper clearly attests.
October 3, 1903. Dr. H.N. Jackson, first man to cross the continent in an automobile, was arrested in Burlington, Vermont, and fined $5 plus court costs for driving the machine more than 6 miles an hour.
Chapter 8, A Signal Triumph. At a celebration of the 100th anniversary of the Louisiana Purchase and Lewis and Clark's remarkable journey, President Theodore Roosevelt spoke in St. Louis, Missouri.
The old pioneer days are gone, with their roughness and their hardship, their incredible toil and their wild, half-savage romance. But the need for the pioneer virtues remains the same as ever. We have every right to take a just pride in the great deeds of our forefathers. But we show ourselves unworthy to be their descendants if we make what they did an excuse for our lying supine, instead of an incentive to the effort to show ourselves, by our acts, worthy of them. Now, in 1903, in the altered conditions, we must meet the changed and changing problems with the spirit shown by the men who in 1803 and in the subsequent years gained, explored, conquered, and settled this vast territory, then a desert, now filled with thriving and populous states.
In 1903, as the nation began celebrating 100 years of growth and expansion since the Louisiana Purchase and Lewis and Clark's epic voyage across the continent, Americans sensed that their world had suddenly gotten much smaller. In 1903, President Theodore Roosevelt sent a New Year's greeting to England's King Edward VII using Marconi's new wireless radio that could transmit signals across the Atlantic. In 1903, a cable was laid across the Pacific Ocean, the last link in a web of wires that allowed Roosevelt to telegraph the first message sent around the world. The complete circuit took 12 minutes. In 1903, the Trans-Siberian Railroad was completed, and with the active encouragement of the United States, Panama declared its independence from Colombia in order to pave the way for a canal to be built between the two great oceans. In 1903, George A. Wyman made the first transcontinental motorcycle trip, bumping along much of the route from San Francisco to New York City by riding on the railroad bed. In 1903, two bicycle mechanics from Dayton, Ohio, named Orville and Wilbur Wright, made the world's first airplane flight, soaring in their gasoline-powered machine over the beaches at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. And farther down the coast that same year, Alexander Winton drove one of his cars an astonishing 68 miles per hour on Daytona Beach. To the Boston Herald, Jackson's achievement seemed particularly significant.
August 4th, 1903. What is admitted to be the greatest automobile performance of the year was the transcontinental tour of Dr. H. Nelson Jackson and his chauffeur from San Francisco to New York. The trip is considered as a signal triumph for the comparatively new means of travel. The journey was made purely for pleasure and to satisfy an enthusiastic motorist that it could be accomplished. But when good roads shall be the rule instead of the exception in every state, it may be predicted with confidence that such journeys as that made by Dr. Jackson will be far from extraordinary.
Within a few years of Jackson and Crocker's trip, an organized movement began in the United States to improve the nation's roads to accommodate the automobile, to provide better surfaces, better maps, better ways for people in cars to travel wherever they wish to go. A new century was unfolding in which the automobile, for better and for worse, would completely transform American life. Just as Jackson had predicted in San Francisco, cars turned out to be much more than a passing mechanical fancy or an unreliable novelty suitable only for short distances. and an entire nation was about to succumb completely to a primary enthusiasm for motoring, just as he had. In 1904, an automobile would be driven across the continent in half of Jackson's time. 2 years later, the time was cut in half once more. In 1908, Jacob Murdoch loaded his wife and children into his new Packard Model 30 and drove from Pasadena to New York City in 32 days, becoming the first family to drive across the country and beginning a tradition of road trips that generations of American families would follow. Murdoch refused to let anyone else behind the wheel, didn't like to ask for directions, and some days kept on the move for more than 12 straight hours in order to put some extra miles behind him. "I know nothing more disheartening," he said, "than to see the sun just about to set below the horizon when one is many miles from the place he had hoped to make that day." By 1913, the nation's first transcontinental motor route, the Lincoln Highway, had been created across the center of the country. And by 1916, an automobile had raced across its entire length in just 5 days' time. Sewell Crocker did not live long enough to see that day. Immediately after his and Jackson's journey in 1903, he had stayed in New York, negotiating with a newspaper to sponsor him on a 6-month automobile expedition around the world. Nothing ever came of it. But he did eventually make a 2-year tour of Europe before being called back to look after some family property in Mexico during that country's revolution. Crocker suffered a nervous breakdown from the strain, took ill, and died in his hometown of Tacoma on April 22, 1913. By all accounts, Bud apparently lived a full dog's life, content to guard the Jacksons' home in Vermont and take short automobile trips around Burlington with his master. Following Bud's death, the Jacksons always kept at least one dog in their house, though none ever became as celebrated as the begoggled bull pup who had crossed the continent. The Winton Motor Carriage Company, later renamed Winton Motor Car Company, then, more succinctly, the Winton Company, rode the waves of publicity surrounding Jackson's trip for as long as it could. But its heavier, higher-priced touring cars were soon outsold by the smaller, cheaper models like the Oldsmobile Runabout that began dominating the market once everyday Americans started buying cars of their own. The company produced its last automobiles in 1924. Horatio Nelson Jackson, meanwhile, never stopped moving forward. In Burlington, he became a successful businessman, newspaper publisher, owner of the town's first radio station, president of a bank. Already in his mid-40s when World War I broke out, he insisted on enlisting in the Army despite his age, even arranged a personal meeting with an aging Theodore Roosevelt to seek the ex-president's intercession on his behalf. At war's end, he returned from overseas a decorated hero, having received the Distinguished Service Cross as well as France's Croix de Guerre. Back in the United States, he helped found the American Legion and later ran unsuccessfully for governor of Vermont. In 1944, to preserve his moment in history, Jackson donated his car, as well as his scrapbook of newspaper clippings and Bud's goggles, to the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., and for the rest of his life, he never tired of telling anyone who would listen the story of his great adventure, crossing the continent with Sewell Crocker and the bulldog Bud in a 1903 Winton called the Vermont. By the time Jackson died at age 82 on January 14, 1955, his nation had already begun planning an interstate highway system, a series of roads that would soon routinely carry millions of cars and trucks from coast to coast, moving at such speeds and in such comfort that someone traveling them would find it nearly impossible to imagine anything like Horatio's Drive.
Song of the Open Road by Dayton Duncan.
Song of the Open Road. Afoot and light-hearted, I take to the open road. Healthy, free, the world before me, the long brown path before me, leading wherever I choose. Henceforth I ask not good fortune. I myself am good fortune. Henceforth I whimper no more, postpone no more, need nothing. Strong and content, I travel the open road. Walt Whitman. Much of the last 20 years of my life has been spent traveling America. I've retraced the entire length of the Lewis and Clark Trail 4 times. In an old Saab, an even older Volkswagen bus, and twice in borrowed Suburbans. Another time, researching a book about the most sparsely populated counties in the United States, I drove 30,000 miles in 12 months crisscrossing the West. Scouting for stories and scenic locations for a documentary film series 2 years later, I crisscrossed the West again. I once went by bus from Keene, New Hampshire, to Keene, California, and back, on a 30-day Greyhound pass, realizing by day 2 that such a trip might make an interesting magazine story, but that there's good reason why the only people who use the bus for long-distance travel are those without any other option. I took the train from New England to the Midwest and back during midwinter, trying to sleep in one coach that had no heat, and then in another that was swelteringly hot. By the time the return train delivered me home exactly 24 hours behind schedule, I had concluded that most long-distance train travelers were either another subcategory of riders without options, phobic about flying, or blindly nostalgic about railroads. And having worked for 2 failed presidential campaigns, I've flown into and out of every airport in every American city big enough to have a television station, ridden countless miles in Secret Service-protected motorcades, and witness photo ops involving every possible mode of transportation from tugboats to tanks. I took a pass on the chance to ride in the tank, a choice the candidate later wished he had made as well. I've traveled the rodeo circuit with cowboys who saw nothing unusual about driving thousands of miles nonstop for 2 days for the chance to ride a wild bronc for 8 seconds, and then set off for the next rodeo 1,000 miles farther down the road. I've climbed into the cabs of 18-wheelers to explore the bizarre life of long-haul truckers who inhabit a parallel universe from the rest of us, an unending, paid-by-the-mile existence confined to interstates and truck stops that makes it possible for a head of Boston lettuce to be harvested in Yuma, Arizona, one morning and consumed in Boston 4 days later. Most recently, following the route of Horatio Nelson Jackson and his historic 1903 automobile trip from San Francisco to New York City, I drove more than 10,000 meandering miles, going coast to coast in 6 weeks. That was for work. For fun, what I enjoy the most is taking my family on long car trips. If my wife, daughter, or son aren't available, I've got good friends with a similar taste for the road as myself. And if they can't make it, well, there's nothing like some time alone behind the wheel to unwind from the stress and strain of jobs or close relationships. Walt Whitman again. You road I enter upon and look around, I believe you are not all that is here. I believe that much unseen is also here. Having revealed my predilections in the spirit of full disclosure, to state now that I believe one of the defining characteristics of Americans is an unquenchable restlessness, an itch to see what's over the next horizon, might seem a solipsism, defining my countrymen by what most clearly applies to me. But I believe it nonetheless, and I'm bolstered in this belief by finding myself in good company. From Walt Whitman to Jack Kerouac, our bards have taken to the open road to find inspiration, to discover themselves and their country, and in turn, to reveal us to ourselves. Even Robert Frost, who might not immediately come to mind in the literature of travel, unless you count his move from New Hampshire to Vermont, acknowledged the central fact of movement to the national experience during the crowning moment of his career, when he became the first poet ever invited to speak at a presidential inauguration, John F. Kennedy's, and intoned that Americans had not found their essence until, quote, we gave ourselves outright to the land vaguely realizing westward. JFK, in turn, declared a new frontier and spurred his nation toward it. For Mark Twain, arguably the representative American, at least in the eyes of the world, restlessness became a way of life. All I do know or feel, he wrote his mother from California as a young man hungry for success, is that I am wild with impatience to move, move, move. I wish I never had to stop anywhere for a month. It was through his first travel books, The Innocents Abroad and Roughing It, that he first achieved the success he craved. It was through Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, his classic road trip novel, even if Huck and Jim's highway was the Mississippi River, that he achieved immortality. Willie Nelson's theme song is On the Road Again. Bruce Springsteen's is Thunder Road. One generation believed you could get your kicks on Route 66, while the next were reminded, through Easy Rider and Thelma and Louise, that not all road trips end quite so happily. Lonesome Dove, the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Larry McMurtry that became a television sensation, is an epic road trip in buckskins, in which a large cast of characters travels a straight, though arduous, line from Texas to Montana. Blue Highways, the bestseller by my friend William Least Heatmoon, is a solo journey that circles the nation. I'm not suggesting that all these works, and the innumerable others like them, created a national psychology of road fever. In fact, I'm arguing just the opposite. They have endured because, like all great works of art, and in Kennedy's case, great political leadership, they resonated in perfect pitch with our national experience. As if we were a diverse array of tuning forks which, if struck just right, begins vibrating in unison the song of the open road, the anthem of our collective history. Walt Whitman tells us, from this hour, freedom. From this hour, I ordain myself loosed of limits and imaginary lines, going where I list, my own master, total and absolute. I inhale great drafts of space. The east and the west are mine. The north and the south are mine. The first refrains of the Song of the Open Road were sung long before we were a nation. When Europeans began arriving in North America more than 500 years ago, they brought with them many things that proved disastrous to Native Americans. Most notably, deadly diseases which quickly spread from tribe to tribe, devastating even those who had never even seen a white man, and a cultural desire to spread across and take over the Indians' land. But the Europeans also brought something that many Western tribes considered so wondrously beneficial that they named it the sacred dog, and totally rearranged their lives around it. It was the horse. Following the Pueblo Revolt of 1680, the horses that the retreating Spanish left behind in New Mexico began spreading throughout the West, transforming each tribe they reached. Almost immediately, a new world opened for people who had relied on their feet to trek great distances and on their dogs to drag their meager belongings. Buffalo were now easier to hunt and could be followed deeper into the Great Plains. Teepees were now easier to move and could be made larger to hold more possessions. Enemies were easier to reach and raid, and horses were the prime booty. Wealth and status were measured by the size of a family's horse herd, and during winter, a man's prized stallion would be staked inside the family's lodge to protect it from the cold. No tribe was unaffected. Some, including the Cheyenne, gave themselves over to the horse entirely, abandoning their fields and permanent villages to take on the life of nomadic hunters. West of the Mississippi, the revolution wrought by the horse was so complete and so sudden that within only a few generations, elders would tell their disbelieving grandchildren tales of life back in the dog days. It was almost as if, in the limitless spaces at the heart of the new world, the native people had been waiting to receive this beast from the old world, adopt it overnight, and through it attain some higher expression of their spirit, proud, free, and mobile. The Cheyenne, in fact, say they had been waiting. According to their stories, their great prophet Sweet Medicine had prepared them in advance. "This animal will carry you on his back and help you in many ways," he had promised his people long before the Cheyenne had heard of horses or white men. "Those far hills that seem only a blue vision in the distance take many days to reach now," he said, "but with this animal you can get there in a short time, so fear him not." Other Native Americans like to point out that the first horse on earth originated in America and became extinct in its homeland at the end of the Pleistocene, though some of its descendants had already migrated across the Bering Land Bridge and survived in Eurasia. From this perspective, the horse did not arrive here 5 centuries ago, it returned, and the people were ready for it. However you want to explain it, throughout the 1700s, America's quintessential song of the open road would have been an exuberant, high-pitched Indian chant, exclaimed full-throated from the back of a galloping horse, punctuated by the thunder of hooves, and reverberating off the blue vision hills that suddenly were not so far away. The road song of the next century had a different melody. In 1803, 100 years before Horatio Nelson Jackson set off from San Francisco, hoping to become the first American to drive an automobile across the continent, Meriwether Lewis departed Washington, D.C., looking to become the first American to cross the continent, period. He picked up William Clark in Louisville and other members of the Corps of Discovery along the way. So despite the immense contributions of these others to the expedition's overall success, Lewis was the only one eligible for the coast-to-coast laurels. Traveling by keelboat and canoe, horseback, and on foot, it took him nearly 2.5 years to make it from the Atlantic to the Pacific. One way to summarize 19th-century American history in the aftermath of Lewis and Clark is a nation in a perpetual rush to find better and faster ways to reach the next horizon, and the next, until the country's vast but alluring distances were conquered. All those horizons, so little time. Beginning in the 1840s, the quest for gold, for land, or the chance to start over, sent hundreds of thousands of pioneers to Oregon and California. Restless Americans like William Swain, a farmer from upstate New York who kissed his wife and baby goodbye, took a series of canal boats and river steamers to Independence, Missouri, and then joined a wagon train bound for the gold fields. 7 grueling months after leaving his family, when he straggled at last into California, he immediately wrote back to his brother, saying, "For God's sake, stay at home." But despite having failed utterly as a prospector, as an old and successful orchardist back in New York, the story he most loved to tell his grandchildren was of his journey across the country in the days of 49. Later travelers rode the overland stagecoach, which cut the time in half. Mark Twain was one of them, going from Missouri to Nevada in 1861 with his piously serious brother to escape the carnage of the Civil War. Riding on the coach's roof, clothed only in his underwear, he reveled in the scenery as the stage rattled through the western mountains. Ham and eggs and scenery, a downgrade, a flying coach, a fragrant pipe, and a contented heart, he said. These make happiness. It is what all the ages have struggled for. But by the time he had reached the end of the Nevada deserts, Twain had concluded that stage travel was so bumpy and dusty that he was glad his brother had brought along an unabridged dictionary, because, he said, "We never could have found language to tell how glad we were in any sort of dictionary but an unabridged one with pictures in it." By 1869, the first transcontinental railroad was completed, and Americans could now cross their nation in a matter of weeks instead of months or years, provided they were content to confine themselves to a railroad schedule. The The remainder of the century was pretty much consumed by extending the railroad's reach to nearly every recess of the country. Not coincidentally, these years also marked the final military conquest of native peoples, in particular the last holdouts, the horse nomads of the plains, who found themselves confined to reservations roughly a century and a half after they had first galloped onto the prairies and felt the wind rush into their lungs. As the last Indian horse herds were being turned in or destroyed by the army, a strange and revealing thing occurred in the popular imagination. The feathered warrior on horseback had become a national image of all Indians and of noble freedom, even though the culture it represented had just been subjugated, even though most tribes had never been nomadic horsemen, even though their moment of glory had been so historically brief. The same thing would soon happen to cowboys. Late in the 19th century, it was the iron horse that ruled the range. But despite its undisputed power and dominance, and perhaps because it seemed so impersonal, so industrial, so constrained by two steel rails to travel only in a straight line, it could never compete with the image of a lone horseman, Indian or cowboy, to communicate unfettered freedom. It would take something entirely new to do that, something that combined a bit of the locomotive's power with some of the mobility of a horse. And once again, while it would appear in Europe first, America is where it would become the icon of a culture utterly transformed by it. At the dawn of the 20th century, the song of the open road was about to be punctuated by a car horn and the clatter of an internal combustion engine. Walt Whitman again. The earth expanding right hand and left hand, the picture alive, every part in its best light, the music falling in where it is wanted and stopping where it is not wanted, the cheerful voice of the public road, the gay, fresh sentiment of the road. I think whatever I shall meet on the road I shall like, and whoever beholds me shall like me. I think whoever I see must be happy. I imagine that the first few days of Horatio Nelson Jackson's trip were the most exhilarating. The departure from San Francisco on that May afternoon of 1903, the salt breeze on the Oakland Ferry, then hitting that first country road and opening up the Vermont, climbing to 10, 15, then 20 miles per hour, maybe even pushing it to the limits of 30 miles per hour or more, just to test it and himself out. A horseman driving a spirited equine will go fast or slow as he releases or increases the pressure upon the sensitive mouth through the driving reins, the Winton Company's sales brochure explained, extolling its revolutionary precursor to a gas pedal. With the Winton control, the brochure continued, the motor speeds up and the car forges ahead when the foot button pressure is increased. Speed of car diminishes when the pressure is released. One quickly learns to operate the governor foot button by instinct. Watching the miles click by on the cyclometer, adjusting the goggles to protect his eyes from the clouds of dust his whirling tires were creating, attuning his ears to the nuances of noise pouring out of the two-cylinder engine directly beneath his seat, getting to know the feel of the vehicle, handling curves, hills, bumps, and stops. Even the first blowout on the first day was probably more exciting than it was exasperating, since they still made 83 miles that afternoon, and Jackson was blessedly insulated from the foreknowledge of how many more tire problems and delays awaited him down the road. That's the way it is with all road trips, and anyone who has spent any time crossing the nation in an automobile immediately recognizes in Jackson's journey the template for all the American road trips that followed. In the early part, with anticipation pumping the adrenaline, everything is fresh and new, and all horizons brim with promise. In the case of Jackson's psychic engine, multiply that 100-fold. As his letters to his wife and peripatetic career after his journey so clearly attest, his innate energy and optimism ran on high octane to begin with. Add to the mix just how new the whole experience really was for Jackson. Not just the unfamiliar scenery, but the viscerally new experience of the way he was traversing it. With no windshield and no top on the Vermont, he met the landscape head-on, seeing it, smelling it, feeling it unfold before him, so unlike the side-view-only perspective from the window of a closed railroad car. And unlike a horse and wagon, his car propelled him down the road at both greater speed and for longer, sustained stretches of time. 83 miles in an afternoon, including a stop to change a tire, was not a typical outing for a horse and buggy. Now add in Jackson's knowledge that what he was doing was not only new for him personally, but new in his people's experience, and the word exhilaration suddenly seems somewhat inadequate. He must have felt like the first Cheyenne who grabbed the mane of a Spanish pony, swung himself up on its back, kicked its flank, and found himself hurtling across the endless grasslands. For Jackson, the blue vision was even more distant, an entire continent away. But particularly in the early rush of the journey, he could see it clearly, and it probably seemed within easy reach. Then came the inevitable troubles and annoyances of the road. More blown tires, running out of gas, then oil. Delays for parts, delays for repairs. Belongings lost or forgotten along the way. Nights interrupted by snoring strangers or bug-ridden beds. The price-gouging merchant, the inedible meal. Bad weather and worse roads. Getting lost and facing the almost unbearable prospect of having to retrace your day's route. As a historical note, it's worth mentioning that Jackson, like Lewis and Clark before him, had absolutely no compunctions about stopping to ask directions, proving, I think, that American males must have developed their obsession against it sometime later, although it's probably also worth observing that no Indians ever deliberately pointed the Corps of Discovery in the wrong direction simply to give some relatives the chance to see their first white man. Maybe Jackson's experience with the girl on the white horse marked a cultural turning point. Jackson met it all with remarkable, unflappable good humor. If "we proceeded on" became the most recurrent phrase in the Lewis and Clark journals, "the worst of it is over" keeps jumping out of Jackson's letters to his wife, usually just before something even worse happens to his plans. One phrase is filled with a kind of grim determination. The other is evidence of either boundless confidence or Pollyannaism bordering on delusion. I prefer to think of Jackson on the confident side of that equation, and as a longtime student of the road have concluded that "the worst of it is over" pairs nicely with "we proceeded on" as the proper attitude for crossing the continent and accomplishing something no one else ever has. Following his trail, there were many moments I wish Jackson had spent more time recording his experience. Take the sagebrush country, for instance. Traveling 10 to 20 miles per hour may have seemed fast to his generation, but it still doesn't get you across great distances very quickly. For 32 days, more than half his time on the road, in the vast space between Alturas, California, to somewhere east of Rawlins, Wyoming, Jackson would have been traveling through one kind of sage or another virtually every day. A month of sagebrush at a speed lower than a school zone's. In that same time, Meriwether Lewis would have produced lengthy descriptions of every variation of sagebrush he encountered, tested its taste and possible medicinal uses, compared it to buffalo dung and cottonwood as a fuel source, elicited local customs and beliefs associated with it, attempted at least one lyrical passage featuring it. "This morning the sun's glancing rays off the blue and green sagebrush presented a most romantic appearance," and probably thrown in numerous other journal entries about how everyone on the expedition felt about it. "Men complain much about the sage, which they say seems to have no end," or "my dog seems constantly bothered by the brush obstructing his view." Mark Twain was more succinct and colorful. "Sagebrush," he wrote from Nevada, "is very fair fuel, but as a vegetable it is a distinguished failure. When crushed, sagebrush emits an odor which isn't exactly magnolia and equally isn't exactly polecat, but it is a sort of compromise between the two." Jackson, by contrast, mentions the sage only 4 times by my count, and always briefly. Twice saying that bad roads forced him and Sewell Crocker to steer the Vermont through the open sage, in one instance stripping off the cyclometer, and twice offering merely that they cut some sagebrush to place under the car's wheels in hopes of getting out of a mud hole. It would be patently unfair to hold Jackson up to the standards of Twain and Lewis, two of America's greatest travel correspondents, but I might have at least expected him to comment on the remarkably fragrant aroma, more magnolia than polecat, that uncrushed sagebrush emits after a rainstorm, since he experienced both sagebrush and rainstorms in such abundance. I also would have appreciated some more descriptions of the scenery from his perspective, more details of the trip beyond Omaha when he became so intent on reaching New York that his letter writing essentially stopped, more elaboration on the personality of his faithful traveling assistant Sewell Crocker, beyond the statement, "He is a mighty good man." And I often wish that Crocker, the William Clark to Jackson's Meriwether Lewis, had given us his own impressions of the journey. I would have liked a little more about the dog, Bud. Did he bark at every farm animal they passed? Where did he sleep at night? Was he more companion than guard dog? But those are minor quibbles compared to the prospect that Jackson might have left behind no on-the-spot written record at all. "Please keep my letters as I want them for reference," he instructed his wife in his very first letter a day after leaving San Francisco. We're lucky that she did. The essence of his character radiates from those letters. A vibrant yet tender love for his wife is in all of them, from the breezy, playful salutations toward Swipes and "you dear little girl," to his recurring apologies for the prolonged separation his quirky yet historic odyssey was causing, from his sweet effort to surprise her with an anniversary dress ordered from the wilds of Wyoming, to the urgency, "watch me now come to you," of his desire to be in her presence once more. His "worst of it is over" spirit exudes from every page. There are elements of confidence as well as irrepressible energy in that spirit, and a likable individualism evident, for instance, when he turns down the Winton Company's offer to subsidize and organize the last half of his expedition. But what emerges most clearly is just how thoroughly he was enjoying his adventure, despite mud holes and misdirections, broken parts and rocky trails, choking dust and long days without the prospect of a comfortable bed or a warm meal. Teddy Roosevelt, touring the West by train that same summer, no doubt would have pronounced it bully to spend a few days with Jackson splashing across streams or rattling up mountainsides in the Vermont. The worse the weather, the bullier. The more physical the exertion required to dig out of buffalo wallows or push boulders out of the way, the bullier yet. What also emerges from the letters is how much Jackson, just like Roosevelt, loved creating a sensation. Not just at the end of his trip, when he was entering the history books, but perhaps even more so near the beginning, on those rough trails and in those remote towns where people who had never seen an automobile in motion dove for cover under their wagons as the Vermont approached, where crowds, alerted by excited telegraph messages, would line the streets for hours, fully expecting that the first horseless carriage to enter their village might zoom through at 90 miles an hour, where schools let out just because seeing a real live auto seemed more important than the day's lessons, just as later children would watch televisions in their classrooms to see a moon landing, where sharp-eyed farmers and ranchers would curiously inspect the Vermont and then offer something in trade for the chance to ride in it, and where sweat-stained blacksmiths, as they assisted Crocker in making some repairs, surely began thinking seriously about expanding their line of services. If, in the early 1700s, some Cheyenne traditionalists argued that the young men parading by on horseback were indulging in a passing fancy, or clung to the belief that the time-honored dog culture would never disappear, oral histories have blessedly spared them from embarrassment by erasing them from memory. More than likely, however, such skeptics existed. 2 centuries later, Jackson crossed the West during a similar moment in time, when doubts about the automobile's future were not only widespread, but well documented. But as he and the Vermont passed through each town, and then as news of his progress began to spread through the nation, a car all the way across the continent, you can almost feel the direction of America's cultural history turning, because the compass arrow of our restlessness had found a new magnetic pole. At the start of the 19th century, Lewis and Clark had crossed the continent and pointed that restlessness westward. The nation followed and was changed forever. Jackson's trip, at the start of the 20th century, admittedly not as epic or far-reaching as the Corps of Discoveries, nevertheless heralded that a new era of dramatic change, for good and for ill, was beginning. One in which Americans would satisfy their restless yearnings by giving themselves outright to the automobile. The more I studied Jackson's journey and retraced his route, the more I realized that while he had set the pattern for every subsequent American automobile road trip, he had also been connecting into something much deeper in our national experience, something that had nothing to do with the gasoline internal combustion engine. I don't know whether sometime in the near future the automobile will go the way of the horse and wagon, although my teenage daughter Emmy, who for at least 3 years has been counting down the days until she turns 16 and can get her driver's license, has pretty much convinced me that the American equation of automobile equals freedom still has some life left in it after 100 years. I do know what I've learned about the cycles of history from the road, and the road teaches such lessons well, since it keeps bumping into history at every intersection. The song of the open road, sung now for centuries on this continent, has many different verses. It has been reinterpreted by each succeeding generation, sometimes set to a new beat and accompanied by new instruments, but they are mostly variations on the same theme. It's not the getting there that matters so much as the going. If it's happiness we think we're after, it's the pursuit that actually makes us happy. Somehow, this song seems born within each of us, and for some reason, consciously or not, it's a tune that we pass along. Walt Whitman tells us, "To know the universe itself as a road, as many roads, as roads for traveling souls. The soul travels. The body does not travel as much as the soul. The body has just as great a work as the soul, and parts away at last for the journeys of the soul." Faced with the need a year ago to travel from our home in New Hampshire to the state of Iowa, my son Will and I decided to turn it into what we call a buddy trip. In his 12 years, we've taken a number of such journeys. Once, when he was 7, we drove to Rhode Island and back, simply so he could check it off from the ever-dwindling list of states he's never visited. When he was 8, we decided to take a looping route that allowed him to pick a stone from the shore of each great lake, and as a bonus, see Niagara Falls. His 9th summer, he and I broke away from a family vacation in the West to scout along Horatio Nelson Jackson's route in northwestern California and southeastern Oregon, covering in one day a section Jackson took more than a week to cross. For the buddy trip to Iowa, Will's principal goal was to eliminate Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, and Tennessee from his to-do list. My motivation was different. We were going back to my hometown for my father's funeral. My wife Diane and Emmy would be flying there to join us, and I thought I needed something to take my mind off the real purpose of the trip. Although once we were underway, especially on those early mornings when I roused my son from sleep to get a quick start on the day, just as my own dad used to wake me in the pre-dawn darkness for long drives to go pheasant hunting or fishing, I realized that perhaps what I really was seeking was reconnecting with his memory before saying goodbye to his remains. Driving along, more memories enveloped me. I remembered how I once sat in the back seat as a young boy, studying how my dad handled the steering wheel, left arm resting on the open window ledge. Remembered trips to the Black Hills and the headwaters of the Mississippi. Remembered him in the passenger seat, me behind the wheel at last, nervously easing our car into the passing lane for the first time under his guidance. And I remembered taking him out in his car shortly before his death to drive him around the county that had been his home for 81 years. Both of us knew, without saying, that this would be his last car ride. We cruised the streets of town as he pointed out places where the milestones of his life took place. We took gravel roads and a state highway to see the farm where my mother had grown up, and he talked of their romantic road trip to Kansas City in 1942 to elope. We even drove out to the interstate for a short spin, because he was curious to see how his 15-year-old car would hold up at turnpike speeds. "Black care," Teddy Roosevelt once wrote, "rarely sits behind a rider whose pace is fast enough. There's something about the open road that promises new beginnings as it simultaneously peels back layer upon layer of the past. Out on the farthest horizon, all lines converge." On a map, the route Will and I ended up taking to Iowa looks as if we wanted to avoid ever getting there. We spent the first night in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and used up the next morning touring the battlefield before another long drive brought us to Charleston, West Virginia. With an earlier departure the next day, we had breakfast, one of the worst biscuits and gravy imaginable, in Ohio, ate lunch, a delicious cheeseburger at a hole in the wall called Bob's, in Indiana, toured Mammoth Cave National Park in Kentucky, and reached Nashville, Tennessee, in time for supper at a place that serves Southern food with iced tea in a mason jar. We washed the miles off with a late-night dip in the motel pool, and Will went to bed content in the knowledge that four more states were under his belt. Before reaching Iowa 3 days later, he had tasted his first grits and loved them. We had spotted license plates from 48 states, all but North Dakota and Hawaii. Our maroonish Suburban had been officially named Redbud in honor of the beautiful flowering trees lining the roads, winning out over my initial suggestion of Old Rusty. I had become as conversant as Will in the song lyrics of Weird Al Yankovic, while he had joined me in the ranks of Marty Robbins experts. And raccoons had taken the lead over opossums in the informal roadkill count we were keeping. We had stopped to watch the mighty Ohio empty into the even mightier Mississippi. We had toured the excavation of an ancient Indian mound village in Illinois. We had inspected a life-sized replica of Lewis and Clark's keelboat in St. Charles, Missouri. We had visited Mark Twain's birthplace and his boyhood home in Hannibal, then explored the limestone cave he made famous in The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. By the time we pulled into Indianola, a small town south of Des Moines, we had added several chapters to our own book of adventures. Like Horatio Nelson Jackson, we had seen the country, touched its history, created imperishable memories. We ourselves were good fortune. Strong and content, we had traveled the open road. "Along, the road is before us," Walt Whitman said. "It is safe. I have tried it. My own feet have tried it well. Will you give me yourself? Will you come travel with me? Shall we stick by each other as long as we live?"
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Horatio's Drive, America's First Road Trip, by Dayton Duncan, with a preface by Ken Burns. Read for you by the authors, with Tom Hanks, Philip Bosco, Kevin Conway, Jonathan Davis, and George Plimpton. This program was produced and directed by Jacob Bronstein. Music performed and arranged by Bobby Horton and Jacqueline Schwab. Text copyright 2003 by Ken Burns and Dayton Duncan. Song of the Open Road essay, copyright 2003 by Dayton Duncan. Production copyright 2003, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
She was so close to his side. Things went just dandy till he got down the road. This something happened to the old machinery. That engine got his goat, off with his hat and coat. Everything needed repairs. He'd have to get out.
under, get out and get under, to fix his little machine. He was just dying to cuddle his queen, but every minute when he'd begin it, he'd have to get under, get out and get under. Then he'd get back at the wheel. A dozen times they'd start to